Ladies and gentlemen, let me begin our discussions this morning by welcoming you all to CSIS and our session for this morning, looking at the question of rule of law versus democratization in China, sponsored by the Freeman Chair here at CSIS, but organized in conjunction and with the cooperation of Sam Zhao, the director of the Center for China-U.S. Cooperation at the University of Denver. I had the fortunate opportunity to speak at Sam's center about 6 months ago in March, an opportunity I recommend to all of you if you are lucky enough to get an invite from Sam. Shortly after that, we had a chance to discuss what we're working on over lunch. And Sam was telling me about the forthcoming publication of this excellent book, Debating Political Reform in China. I hope you've all had a chance to get your hands on a copy, and if not, they are for sale there at the back of the room. And Sam says he's giving away some if people are special. But what struck me about this is how timely this book is and how well organized and how interesting Sam has put together this volume as a kind of critique of a now well-known and somewhat controversial essay first published, I think, in the first written or drawn up by Pan Wei, a Beijing University-based intellectual in China, a U.S.-educated intellectual who, back in the late 90s, 1999, first wrote an essay, which is very penetrating and, if nothing else, controversial, but well-argued, suggesting that it is possible, sort of in a legalist tradition, for China to pursue social, political, and legal environment which does see the introduction of greater and greater rule of law, but which can be done under the broad framework of one-party Chinese communist rule in the country. Sam wisely encouraged him to get that published in English. It came out in the Journal of Contemporary China a couple of years ago, and this sparked this debate, which now is fully elaborated in this new book. And I said, well, Sam, you know, why don't you come to Washington? Because this issue is extremely important, and I think the turnout today is indicative of that. This is a set of issues that I think Americans really want to know a lot more about, want to know more about what the debate is in China on this question, because Pan Wei surely does not have the last word in China on this question, and to think a little bit more deeply about how international scholars and other analysts have looked at this argument and to think about what alternatives there may or may not be for China's social, political, and legal future going forward. So we're very, very fortunate today to have a number of excellent scholars, some who have participated in this debate that Sam has structured, others who, through their day-to-day research and practical work, are very much involved in looking at these questions and coming up with very, very interesting answers. So we'll have two sessions this morning. I'll moderate the first one, which we'll turn to in just a moment. We'll have a second session following a coffee break, and then we'll have some lunch. And we're very fortunate to have an excellent speaker at lunch today. Unfortunately, at the very, very last minute, almost quite literally the last minute, we had hoped that Dennis Wilder, the acting senior director for Asian Affairs in the White House, would be able to come and speak. This is an issue which seizes Dennis very much, one which he has spoken on a number of times in the past, and I know he was very, very interested to be with us today. But at the last minute, the president asked Dennis to join him up in New York at the opening session of the UN General Assembly. And, well, I guess the president trumps the Freeman chair. Not surprising. There we are. But we are nevertheless very fortunate in his stead to have secured the speaking services of an excellent replacement. So at lunch today, we'll have Carl Minzner, who just on Friday had his last day as a senior counsel at the Congressional Executive Commission on China, where he was deeply involved in analyzing these questions of human rights, rule of law, and democratization in China, and who, I'm very proud to say, officially beginning today and for the next several months, is joining the Freeman Chair as a visiting fellow under the auspices of a Council on Foreign Relations, International Relations Fellowship, where he will be carrying out work on the question, at least for us, he'll be carrying out work on the sources of social unrest in China. So we're very pleased that Carl, on last-minute notice, is prepared to speak to us today about Congress's approach to some of these questions and where he sees the issue of human rights, democratization, and rule of law going in U.S.-China relations in the coming years. All right, enough with the administrative stuff. Let's get into the substance of today's session and, again, welcome all of you. We're very fortunate to have two of our country's leading analysts, specialists, and practical assessors of questions of democracy, rule of law in China. We'll first hear from Jerry Cohen. Well, I guess our schedule actually has Sam speaking first. Sam is familiar to all of you as a specialist on questions of democratization and nationalism in China and its impact on domestic and international policies of that country. As we said, now the director out in Denver of the Center for China-U.S. Cooperation. Jerry Cohen, also well known to all of us here as a professor at New York University, a counselor of the international law firm Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison, also a senior fellow with the Council on Foreign Relations, and a person who is very much deeply involved in a personal and professional way on the kinds of questions we're going to be discussing today. So I couldn't ask for a better group to begin today's session. We'll go for about an hour. I'm asking our speakers to take just 15 minutes to give a short presentation and then allow a lot more time for give and take. One additional point, we asked that this be closed to the press today, so for any of you who might have had some concerns that things you would say or do would be end up in the front page of the New York Times tomorrow, don't worry. We've asked the press to actually not attend, and if there are any members of the press today here, we do ask you to honor, obviously, that this is entirely off the record. But with that, we turn the floor over to Sam Zhao. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Baskio. And I'm glad I invited you last, 6 months ago to Denver, so I'm here now. And quite a few people have been Denver, so if I've been invited, every time I invite a person to Denver, I'll be in many places in next several months. In any case, this is a conference on the rule of law and democratization, two very important issues that facing countries of modern world and particularly reformers in China. In fact, the book is a debate about this issue. As Gates mentioned that, the idea for the book came after Peng Wei wrote a very controversial article, which was published first time in 1999 in an intellectual journal in China called Zhanlue Yu Guanli, Strategy and Management. And that journal has a very big audience among Chinese elites of intellectual circles. Unfortunately, that journal has been closed, I think, a few years ago. And although his argument, for that argument, he has earned the title of a China's leading member of the Liu Kang in Beijing, just like in Washington, some people have that title. And then I asked Peng Wei to translate that essay into English and make some updates and revisions, then invite some Western and Chinese scholars to make response to his argument. And before the book was published, then I invite him to write a reflection on this debate. In fact, to get him to write is very difficult afterward. He is not that responsive. But in any case, that's the book afterward. After all, the key issue of the debate in the book is if the single party rule can adequately facilitate China's modernization, or a multi-party democracy is required. Of course, in Washington and many, in the Western capitals, many people expect or propose a democratization, multi-party competition in China. But if you go to Beijing, in China, talking to many Chinese officials and also Chinese scholars, what they have proposed, political reform, that's a title subject, in fact, political reform in China is to improve rather than replace the Communist Party role, the one-party role in China, but making the single-party role, single-party system more efficient and providing it with a legal base. That's what they are talking about. In that case, the Communist Party will continue to be instrumental, in their view, for maintaining political stability, which in a Chinese government mind is a precondition for economic modernization, or at least for rapid economic growth. So Pan Wei is a representative of these view. Because in fact, we invite Pan Wei to come to the conference, but he said he will not come to Washington just for half-day conference. So he cannot make it here. In that case, I would like to briefly introduce his view. In his essay, if you read the book, he started by raising two questions. Why has China not impressed democracy? And should we consider alternatives when the change in China is unlikely to lead to democracy? By raising these questions, he clearly assumes that China has not impressed democracy and is unlikely to impress it, at least in the immediate future. Starting from this assumption, Pan argues that because China's political, social development, and traditional culture are different from the West, democracy is not a best fit for China as it is for the Western countries. As an alternative, he proposes that what he called a consultative rule of law regime. And this regime is a mixed regime derived from the Chinese tradition of civil service via examination and the Western tradition of legalism and liberalism via the separation of power to form checks and balance. By rule of law, Pan means the supreme authority of the established legal requirements. The authority of law is established when the law enforcement agencies are made accountable to law instead of to elected officials, to law, or he called representatives of interest groups. He believed that a legalist instead of democratic direction of political reform is a logic development in light of China's particular social setting and the political culture. He supports his argument in his essays. In one way, he identifies four types of relationship between democracy and rule of law in countries of the contemporary world. One, countries with democracy but not rule of law. Two, countries with rule of law but not democracy. Three, countries with both rule of law and democracy. Fourth, countries with neither. And he believes that although the fourth type, the country with neither, is the worst one, the first one, countries with democracy without rule of law, is not bad. It's not good either. It's also bad. These two types have existed in many third world countries, and it's likely, in his word, to decay to chaos, corruption, and unsustainable development, and eventually result in tyranny. That's his view. The third one, with both rule of law and democracy, is ideal, the best, but not for every country. So in that case, the second type has been proven, in his view, to be a viable political option, especially for countries without democratic tradition. He gave examples Hong Kong and Singapore as the examples of second type. And well-governed countries with efficient and clean government. That's what he said. Pan Wei therefore suggests that political reform in China has not been and should not be simply democratizing the polity. In addition, he provides many explanations why it should not be that case. For China case, he provides four explanations why rule of law is a more promising option than democracy in China. I don't want to give details, just mention that. First, China is not a hotbed for larger social political groups. Second, Chinese people have difficulty to identify with power politics. Third, what popularly demanded in today's China is not liberty, but fair terms of competition. Basically, he said that's kind of try to compete for the government connections cannot be resulted by democratization, electoral politics, but rule of law. Fourth, the Chinese social setting and the tradition of rule by moral principles are compatible with an essentially rule of law regimes. Based upon these explanations, Pan proposed a consultative rule of law regime of six penal structure. First, a neutral civil service system. Second, an autonomous judicial system. Third, extensive social consultation institutions. Fourth, an independent anti-corruption system. Fifth, the independent auditing system. Sixth, the freedom of speech, press, assembly, and association. Comparing to democratization option, Pan Wei believes that the proposed regime is more feasible. And among the most feasible reasons, he said, the Communist Party will accept that. Democratization will not be accepted by the Communist Party. This will be accepted by the Communist Party because it does not change the Communist Party's role. Will not change the basic structure of the political system, but improve the rule of the Communist Party within the single party system. Of course, Pan Wei's argument is very provocative, controversial. In fact, if you read the book, I would say that most of our contributors agree with Pan Wei that building the rule of law instead of democracy is the most likely option of path of political reform in China under the current leadership. But they are critical of Pan's assertion that democracy is not a fit for China and believe that it would be impossible to have genuine legal reform without democratization. I think other presenters might also present that view. Let me give a very brief couple of examples. Larry Diamond, in his chapter, indicates that although Pan's consultative rule of law regime is a potentially important step along the path of political reform, it is in essence a liberal autocracy, he said, and goes only part of the way toward addressing the deficiencies of the governance in China. It is therefore best viewed as a transitional framework. In other words, competitive elections are required to give local officials incentive to serve the public good and enable bad officials to be removed by the people. Ultimately, China can only achieve adequate and enduring political accountability and stability by moving toward democracy. That's the criticism. Another critic by Ed Friedman, for example, also says, Pan Wei subscribed to wrong medicine to treat China's problems. Although Pan's solution put together an ancient wisdom of Chinese Confucianism and legalism is not a way to attain the liberties and lawfulness that Pan thought to achieve, but likely to produce a despotic rule by the law. That's the argument. So democracy in that case is still an ultimate goal. But some contributors, some scholars do have do sympathetic to Pan's argument. For example, Gunter Schubert, a German scholar, in fact, he was invited and agreed to come, but he cannot make it, not made it because he had delegation in Germany at this moment. He presses that Pan provides us with a democratic theory translated into a concept of one-party rule that combines elements of the Western liberal tradition with the Chinese tradition of meritocracy. Even only partially implement Pan's legal reforms, a modern civil service structure, and more mechanisms of political consultation may help the Communist Party regime to gain new legitimacy, at least for a while, if not a long time. So Schubert believes that Pan's consultative rule of regime is the most realistic variant of democracy in China that one can hope for the near future. I guess Germans may be different from Americans because not American scholars are very critical of this. I myself also kind of sympathetic to Pan's argument. In my view, first of all, I see that incumbent Chinese reformers have indeed taken the rule of law and political liberalization without democratization as a solution to many of China's problems related to the authoritarian one-party system. Second, this approach has indeed produced dramatic political changes, including great individual freedom and economic development. However, I agree with other scholars, American scholars especially, that democracy should be the ultimate option for China because many problems Pan Wei discussed cannot result by only by the rule of law he proposed. I think I'll just stop here and leave for discussion. Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Again, bye.
Sam Zhao, thanks very much. A model of precision and concision that I hope all of our speakers can emulate, which outlines very well the basic argument that Pan Wei has put forward and some of the critiques, both sympathetic and contrary, that have emerged in the work that you've done in this book. Let's turn the floor over then to Jerry Cohen. Thank you.
When I was asked to come here to discuss problems of democracy and the rule of law, I thought naturally I'd have to discuss Guantanamo, CIA interrogations, congressional executive struggles, and the kinds of problems that are really confronting us today in America. This is not... Can we do this?
Maybe.
This is not a... I'm not very high-tech. A Chinese problem. We can learn a lot, however, about our own values and institutions from a look at China. Exegesis on comparative law, but I always tell my students the worst kind of comparative law compares our theory and their practice. Now, the other day we had a visitor at NYU. We have a program called Asia Hour. I like to invite in people who are engaged in practical relations with China. We had a commercial officer from our Shanghai Consulate General. And a very nice crowd of new idealistic young students, over 30 of them from China, getting graduate training in America. And this fellow I'd never met before. Usually, diplomats speak diplomatically on sensitive subjects. But he started out by saying, "For 4 years, I've told every business that comes to Shanghai, don't go to court, don't go to the police, Don't go to the city government for solving your problems. You won't get anywhere. They have no rule of law. And people just were shocked. I was a little surprised myself. So I had to take up the other side, and we had a terrific discussion. But I could see pain, embarrassment, anger on the faces of the young Chinese lawyers who were present. This is a more sophisticated audience. I didn't say jaded. And I'm sure I don't have to apologize in advance if I wound your feelings by following the Chinese slogan, sure, sure, cho, sure. Speak truth to facts. We have to start with reality. So that's my first point. It's wonderful to come to a meeting of social scientists, foreign policy people, and think about the bigger picture, because I often get involved with the nitty-gritty, and this inspires me to take a higher view of things. But we should deal with reality. Now, I don't support the communist system in China, but they control the terrain, as we finally recognized in 1979. I do think we should support the Chinese people. I think to do that, we have to deal with the real world as we find it, not that as we hope it will be someday in the future. And we want to improve the lives of people on the ground. And we have to recognize that this regime, with all its failings, and the price, of course, has been very high, has done more to improve the economic and social conditions of more Chinese people than any regime in history. And that's just a fact. As I say, the price is very high, and the people can't freely decide whether it's acceptable to them. Now, I don't see any prospect for democratization in China in the foreseeable future. Everything I say is limited to the foreseeable future, which can only be not very far, perhaps 5 years ahead or what. And we can't foresee the unforeseeable by definition. But I think we have to deal with the fact we have a relatively successful communist elite who nevertheless are beset by cruel problems. They live on the knife edge of not being able to cope with all these problems. And even though they're 9 able engineers, it's a daily challenge. Now, I don't think, therefore, for me, it's not interesting to deal every day with working toward democratization in China. I wish it were. I wish the Chinese people could have the kind of democratic East Asian-style government that some of China's neighbors have. We know the flaws in Japan's system. We know the flaws in Taiwan, South Korea, Singapore, etc. But still, it would be great if China could have such a regime. I do recognize the doubts of people who say they can't hack it on mainland China. Conditions just aren't the same. It would be dangerous. The regime might fall apart. Calls for democratization are really calls for undermining China's stability and integrity. I'm not so cynical, but I do have doubts. Still, I wish they could try it. But they're not about to try it. China's very economic and social success reduces the likelihood that there's enough steam in the populace to demand democratization. The risk is too high, as seen by many people in China. So for me, I don't mean to be crude, but talk about democratization in China is pie in the sky. I'm an old guy. I haven't got much time to go. I have to concentrate on realistic things, practical improvements where we can make them. And if you want a wonderful statement of that kind of philosophy, you should read something I just read this morning by Sidney Rittenberg. It's additions to his autobiography, a new edition. And it's a profound statement of not only how wrong one can be when idealistic about China and the world, but also how much one can learn and how it's important to concentrate on the practical. What about the rule of law? Well, is that pie in the sky for China also? Many people think it is. The problems are pretty overwhelming. You could start by reading the essay Chapter 8 by Professor Zhang Chenfan in this book. I never heard of this guy before. He's a political scientist. He doesn't get all the details right about court operations and all that, but I think it's a penetrating essay that realistically confronts how do you change the world's oldest political legal culture? It's very, very hard. And yet we know China has made progress toward a rule of law. If you ever want assurance on that score, you could do what I did a few years ago. I dealt with North Koreans for a number of weeks, trying to introduce them to the basics of international business law. And when you deal with North Koreans and you go to North Korea, you see how much progress China has made. Because I said to the North Koreans, you know, they want to set up law firms. They want to take part in the world. And I said, get yourself a political legal culture. Of course, they have one. And that's the problem. And a lot of it comes from China. But the Chinese have made progress. And yet there are formidable obstacles to the creation of a rule of law in China. Professor Pan Wei, Sam, Zhao, and others, of course, recognize that. And why would a Communist Party elite that enjoys almost total power in China, and I stress enjoys, why would they voluntarily give up this power to a large extent and allow an independent, autonomous, fair, impartial judiciary, not subject to their decisions? Well, I think there are maybe two possibilities, and I don't see either immediately on the horizon. One is there may come to power at the top of the Standing Committee of the Politburo some leader who is bold enough, imaginative enough, vigorous enough, and attuned to the rising demands of the mass population that is increasingly rights conscious, to make his political platform and peculiar contribution to China's future the establishment of a genuine rule of law in order to bring about more social harmony, in order to deal with stability, to the forces of instability, instead of merely repressing them. It would take someone with great power, will, determination. Chairman Mao had that power, that will, but he didn't have that vision. He had a different vision, and we know the consequences. Deng Xiaoping didn't have as much power as Mao, but in some ways more. He was highly respected. He was innovative. He was imaginative. He was bold. And he used those qualities, of course, to achieve very significant economic reform internally and externally, to have a volte-face in China's foreign policy, to do what no one else might have done, have these very unusual arrangements about the future of Hong Kong, and he carried it off. Unfortunately, Deng Xiaoping also didn't have a vision of the rule of law. In fact, you remember Deng Xiaoping presided over the Fanyopai Yundong, the anti-rightist movement of 1957-58 that introduced 20 years of repression in China. And Deng, of course, gave the orders for June 4th, 1989 and presided over a lot of other repression in the 80s and the 90s until his death. He and Mao didn't love Montesquieu. They didn't believe in the separation of powers. So but that kind of leader with a different, more enlightened vision, responding to different circumstances in China, where the demand for the rule of law these days is not in conformity with normal Western scholarship about how the rule of law arose, the demands of a rising entrepreneurial bourgeoisie for protections against arbitrary government. In China, most of the bourgeoisie who are rising are joining the party or using their guanxi and connections. They're not relying on a genuine rule of law. They're manipulating it. But the déraciné, the people without power, the uprooted, those who are suffering, the ignorant who are studying law on their own, not in law schools, barefoot lawyers like my friend Chen Guangcheng, who's locked up in Shandong. These people are relying on the rule of law. They are trying to take seriously the propaganda that the party leadership has really given them for years, the institutions of law that the party has allowed to be introduced into China, but doesn't really want to see fully implemented. But these people are trying to call the bluff of the leadership. And that's where the struggle is in China today. A second possible scenario doesn't come from a confident, empowered leader, bold enough to make these changes. It comes from a leader who's threatened. Desperate, not housewives, but leaders who see their power eroding, who see a government that isn't responding to the rising demands for rule of law and even democratization, but who are agile enough, even in old age, to respond in the hope that this might sustain them in power when continuing repression might be too costly or might even fail. Think Zhang Jingguo in the mid-80s in Taiwan. When I first visited Taiwan, Zhang Jingguo was known to be the head of the secret police, a killer, not a very nice guy. Well, by the mid-80s, Zhang Jingguo, unlike most of us, seemed to have liberalized. And he saw what the handwriting was on the wall and decided to respond positively to these pressures. So a second possible scenario in China is a leadership that wants to adopt a genuine rule of law, not because it has the ideology of the rule of law, but because it thinks that's the most practical way to respond to a difficult, increasingly difficult situation. I don't know, of course. In the communist system, it's very hard to identify who are possible leaders of this nature. Who knew before January 1956 that Khrushchev was going to start de-Stalinization? Nothing in his career until he assumed power gave any evidence of it. Who knew about Gorbachev, even though he'd been to law school? He was hiding his hand until he took power. Similarly, in the Chinese system, we can't tell. We can't even tell after next year's 17th Party Congress whether the Who Won leadership might be crypto rule of law people. There are optimists who say, wait, give them another year. We see signs that they're putting legally trained people into the party disciplinary commissions, etc. I don't see much evidence. I'm an optimist. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gone into Chinese studies. But the fact is, I still need some evidence. I can understand the theory that says they've got to consolidate their power. Wait one more year and you'll see their true colors. I have no idea. It wouldn't shock me, but it would surprise me given the record to date. Everybody is watching personnel changes in China. Is the Minister of Public Security, Zhou Yunkang, going to move from the Politburo to the Standing Committee of the Politburo? Will he become, replacing Logan, the head of the Party Political Legal Committee? Will he also take over the Party Discipline and Inspection Committee? If he did, this would give him unprecedented power over the direction of the Chinese legal system. Is Zhou Yunkang a political legal reformer? He's made some reforms within the Ministry of Public Security, most of which are visible. He's tried to get control of local public security entities more securely for the center, but I don't think he's likely to be the person to do that. And the fact is, he's the only law enforcement official in the Politburo today. I had hoped at the time of the 16th Party Congress that the Supreme Court President Xiaoyang was going to get into the Politburo. That would have been an important symbol of the leadership's interest in a genuine rule of law. Xiaoyang is not a friend of mine. I'm not close to him. I'm too often critical of those guys. But the fact is, within his very limited political power, he and his colleagues have been working very, very hard at the wholesale level to make incremental reforms in the court system. They can't do too much. They promise much more than they can deliver. They, too, have to be optimists. If you read the second five-year plan for reforming the courts, it's full of ambition. It's full of contradiction. It shows the limits of real legal reform in a communist party system. I don't say every one-party system has to present these difficulties. There are one-party systems and one-party systems. This one happens to be one that insists on permeating every unit in society, as you well know. But there can be one-party systems that have much less reach. Is Japan a one-party system? The LDP has been the dominant party with all its factional strife for half a century or more. The courts in Japan have a considerable amount of judicial independence, although sociologists of law can show the restraints under which they implicitly operate. You could have that kind of a one-party state. It depends on what kind of interpretation the party leaders want to give to their leadership in order to assure their survival in the future. Well, let's assume somebody comes into office and says, I'm going to make the rule of law my platform. My 10 years at the top will see us establish a genuine rule of law. We'll stop trying to control individual court decisions. We'll stem corruption of the courts. We will take steps like the Qing Dynasty did, at least, to stop local protectionism, the law of avoidance, officials don't go back to their home turf, etc. We'll try to curb Guanxi, which is the hardest job. How do you stop people from doing favors for husbands, cousins, family members, classmates, friends of friends, etc., instead of doing their job as judges? These obstacles are really formidable. How can they be dealt with? Well, right now, China's leaders are a long way from this kind of thinking. It's too bad. Right now, they're, I won't say trapped, like my good friend Min Xinpei recently did in describing the dilemma of the Chinese government, but they're frozen. They're hoist by their own petard. They don't know whether to move forward on law reform or to stop. Some, I'm sure, wish they could move backward and never got into this Western-inspired mess. Because the fact is, they have filled people for decades now with the rhetoric of the rule of law. They have brought in Western-style laws, institutions, procedures, values, ideology, amended the Constitution with human rights have to be protected, property rights have to be protected. A populace that wasn't legalistic before, that earlier had no hope for using the courts and related institutions to solve their grievances and protect their interests, now has been inspired to try it. And the government's saying, don't go into the streets. You mustn't riot. But at the same time, the government says, don't get too many Western ideas either. And they're telling the courts, judges, prosecutors, lawyers, don't take too seriously these institutions and ideas. We're Chinese. We're not going to go Western. And so they're getting the worst of both worlds. They're keeping the promise to the ear, as Shakespeare said, and breaking it to the hope. People are going and trying these institutions because they have no other way out. The petition system that Carl Minzner has so well described is by and large unsuccessful. And the party doesn't even want lawyers to help people further their rights to petition. They're afraid that these institutions will take on life. So they're really stuck. This is where they are. That's why you have no legislation now to do away with Laudong Jiaoyang, re-education through labor, the power of the police to put you away on their own for 3 or 4 years with no prosecutor, no court review. That's why they haven't enacted the dozen important criminal procedure reforms they're ready to enact intellectually. Underneath the leadership, you have a tremendous effort by hundreds of thousands of sincere legal experts in and out of government to improve the criminal procedure law and to facilitate China's adherence to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which China signed in 1998. Until recently, the word was, we're going to have a new criminal procedure law, and that law will reflect the demands of the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights by 1998, when the Olympics come, and we're going to adhere to the Covenant by 1998. This would have a profound effect on internal arrangements in China, more profound than entry into the WTO did. But now, with this conservative, put it mildly, climate running, and indeed tolerance of lawlessness by the police and their thugs in all too many cases throughout China, I just don't see it. I see the NPC frozen. Only one area of activity now takes place in China. That's a law reform nature. I'm not talking about the business world. We can talk about that later if you like. Death penalty reform, and that isn't legislative. The Supreme Court is doing that on its own, taking a somewhat expansive view of its powers, undoubtedly annoying the legislature. But because the legislature isn't acting, the Supreme Court, as often in the past, has to take some initiative. And they are trying in their own way, very slowly, against great difficulties, to find the 300 or 400 judges they have to add to their staff to take on serious review of death penalty cases. And they have to train the high courts and even the trial courts so that death penalty adjudication will begin to look more like due process of law. Well, I could go on, but my time is up. We're going to have a program Wednesday at the Congressional Executive Commission on China in the morning. And if any of you are interested in the details, that would be another occasion. But thanks very much.
Our thanks go to you, Jerry. As usual, such an insightful and inspiring and thought-provoking presentation to have us thinking about these issues in a very practical and immediate sense. I thank you, too, for being so good about trying to keep to time. We do have 10 or 15 minutes to have a discussion, take some questions, pose some issues here to our speakers, or to raise points of your own. I'll ask you to identify yourself just so our speakers, in case they don't know you, will know who you are. And I'll first recognize Stanley, please. And I'll try to take down a list.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. The engine of democratization in the West was taxation. Magna Carta, the barons were fed up with King John demanding money. The American Revolution, no taxation without representation. The French Revolution, the Estates General were convened because Louis XVI was desperate for money. The treasury was empty. Nothing was mentioned about taxation. Could taxation be the engine of democratization in China?
Interesting thought. Anyone care to respond to that?
Well,
use your mic there, Jerry. Thank you.
The regime has been somewhat belatedly very sensitive to that. That's why they recently abandoned the agricultural tax. One of the causes that spawned the rise of barefoot lawyers when actual lawyers couldn't or wouldn't take up the cause was unfair taxation, especially discrimination against the disabled. And China is still saddled with all these fees, but the regime is very sensitive about that and trying to remove that cause. In urban areas, the successful bourgeoisie have their ways of dealing with taxes, and China at least is similar to Italy in that respect.
Please.
Blair King from the National Democratic Institute. I wanted to ask if this situation in which you have rule of law but not democracy, if either of you think that that's sort of an equilibrium. In other words, if the West helps China establish the rule of law, but in the absence of democratization, does that end up making China a more efficient and, in essence, more stable authoritarian system, or is that sort of a leading step towards democratization in the future? Jerry, you talked about how China's economic and social success actually makes democratization less likely because people aren't willing to risk the instability. But of course, many other theories posit that economic growth creates either a middle class or a working class that then agitates for greater democratization.
There are so many factors, it's so many uncertainties. Of course, it's very hard to say. But I spent about 10 years of my life living in Hong Kong before 1997. And Hong Kong, of course, as has been mentioned in Panway notices, can hardly have been described under the colonial government as a democracy. Now, you could say yes, but the colonial government's policies were subject to democratic rule back in the UK. But the fact was, because these people had a political legal culture that really fostered legalistic thinking and ethical thinking that goes with it, Hong Kong was an example of a very undemocratic place that had a highly acceptable rule of law, especially after the Independent Commission for Corruption came into play in a serious way in the late 70s. And that's another thing. You need to curb corruption. You need a free press. Hong Kong's press was really quite free. And they did a great job after 76 in curbing corruption. So that's one, but there's so many variables here. It's very hard to look and come out with an answer in the crystal ball.
Yes, in fact, I think that's exactly what the Chinese government has hoped for, that is, have order and then have political stability, then economic modernization, economic development, but without democracy, at least in near future. But the problem is that what the Chinese Communist Party government wants to have would not necessarily be the actual result. In fact, even those scholars in China who, I mean, Liu Kangs will call them in China, they have to admit that eventually this legal development and pluralization of the society and that kind of impulse in the political process, either, I mean, even in legal sense, would eventually let an open society, open competition in the political system. Democratization may be the eventual result. I mean, this process would lay a foundation for democracy in the future, but not now. I think that's the current argument.
I think many leaders in China would think it would be wonderful if someday rule of law efforts could lead them to a Singapore-type stability. But has anyone ever won a defamation suit against Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore?
Okay, we have at least six people that I have tried to identify here. I'm going to try to get through that list and see how we're doing in terms of our time. Recognize Jim Feinerman and then Jim had his hand up first, and then we'll go to the lady behind you, if you don't mind. Thank you.
Jim Feinerman from Georgetown Law Center. I just want to note that Jerry mentioned he was an optimist. When I started studying Chinese in high school in the 1960s, they said that the optimists were studying Russian and the pessimists were studying Chinese. But I think there's reason that all of us have been rather optimistic, at least until recently, about the development of the rule of law in China. Certainly things are vastly better on legal grounds as well as the economic grounds that you mentioned, and the improvement of the lives of the Chinese people compared to what it was during the Cultural Revolution or even in the late 70s and early 80s when economic reform began. But it seems to me that the bigger concern is in the last three or four years, I'd be hard-pressed to say today that things have continued to get better. And in fact, it seems to me that things have gotten worse. Now, this may be a comment better addressed to the next panel. But if you go back to the mid-1990s, when the new formulation was adopted about the rule of law, this term, ifa jirguo, a country ruled by law, I think you see the beginnings of something that may have come to fruition today, where you have the worst of both worlds with regard to the rule of law. You have law without the rule of law. And this rule by law that the party can claim exists in China today is actually possibly a tool for much more efficient repression, cloaked with the rule of law as a way of addressing the objections of foreigners.
Sam, you want to comment on that? Or
I agree with that. The improvement in the rule of law in China, I think, has been very impressive. All those kind of Wei Quan Yundong China called the civil rights, maybe that's not the right word for that civil rights movement. It's a rights protection movement in China that has occurred, I think, just 3 or 4 years ago. Has been very impressive. Without the kind of progress in the promotion of rule of law, we would not see that kind of protection of rights movement. In fact, looking at the Chinese constitution, for example, the constitution had been for so many years just a Communist Party propaganda instrument. But there's constitutional reform in China, I would say, in the last decade. China had four constitutions before 1982. Then there are four amendments in response to each of the National Party's Congress had amendments. Look at those amendments. All those amendments are articles to protect individual rights. The last one, year 2004, they said the private property is not vulnerable in this amendment. So the constitutional constitutional reform, and also look at the decision-making process in the top level of Chinese government. It's also moving by rules, by normative procedures.
But Sam, look, mm-hmm. You're giving the impression that this rights defender movement is active and flourishing. They are being decimated.
Yeah.
They are getting precisely the treatment that the Falun Gong got before them, that the Democratic Party got before them, that many religious groups have got before them. Gao Zhisheng has been arrested and disappeared. Cheng Guangcheng has just been sentenced to 4 years and 3 months. Lawyers who try to defend them get beaten up. You try to visit their families, and the police interfered. I was in Shanghai in June. I tried to call on Zheng Enchong and his wife. He just came out of jail after 3 unjust years, having had his lawyer's license taken away and his ability to practice. I wasn't allowed to visit him by the police, and I repeatedly said, what's your authority? What you're doing is totally illegal. And they just kept saying, woman, sure, Jing Cha, we're police. And you don't need any authority if you're Jing Cha. I mean, please don't give the impression that these rights defenders are flourishing in China. They are under severe personal threat and punishment.
I agree they are under severe punishment. However, what you can now to have all those news came out of China, you have international lawyers, international visitors to talk about those issues, even get a lot of information about those issues. I think that itself is a very big change.
See, you're happy to settle for talk. You're happy to settle for words on a printed page. I'm talking about life. You're supposed to be a political scientist and deal with reality.
May I?
I'm from IFES. We are a democratic assistant organization, so we are a practitioner. We actually have ongoing rule of law projects in China. The one we finished was with the Supreme People's Court, 2 workshops. Interestingly, the first one was about enforcement, the second one was about the Chinese independence and transparency of the Chinese judiciary. You can imagine what we did. We had judges from all provincial courts from all over China, and the discussion came to a conclusion. We did not go in imposing any conclusion, but the judges discussed among themselves, came to a conclusion that is the independence and transparency cannot be reached with one party and the party interference. So I guess what I want to say as a Chinese, I'm a Chinese nationality, I worked for the Chinese government before, is that we agree as a practitioner, Chinese government's resistance on rule of law programs are much, much less than when you go and say we would like to expand democracy. However, Professor Zhao, the Sikhs expect that you mentioned, automatic independent rule of law cannot be reached without democracy. But I agree with you that we cannot wait for democracy to get there and then we start working on rule of law. Then that comes to the second point I would like to make, which is towards Professor Cohen, that yes, democracy will not be realized within foreseeable future. However, I'm still optimistic because what can be better than the officials and judges come to the conclusion themselves that the problem is the one-party rule and the problem is the lack of that real democracy. So I appreciate also the point you made that we are waiting for a leader. Either the leader is with power, with vision, or under pressure. And I would like to see that a real democracy would be best achieved by homegrown demand, which we are seeing in China right now. And what we do as practitioner is we would go in, plant seeds, but working with leaders or judges at middle level and support them and push them in a way toward that direction. And when the leader that I would argue that would help us to see that leader to come into sight, but at the same time, when the opportunity is right, we have a homegrown but also mid-level leaders who will carry that reform through.
Okay, thank you. We're looking at a shortened period of time here. I want to just take a couple more questions. Those are very good questions posed directly to both of you, if you could respond to that. May I have this gentleman have a word? I'll get to Bob Kapp, and I think we may have to stop it at that. I'm afraid we're running out of time. I'm very sorry about that.
Thank you. Earl Carr from the Keenan Institute. Jerry, you laid out two scenarios. One is, as was stated, a leader having that bold vision to implement change, as well as a leader kind of desperate and kind of... I would like to propose a third scenario, and wanted to know what you thought, which is, could a changing agent be foreign direct investment and China being able to be viewed as a credible nation to other countries as really being able to attract more foreign direct investment as a changing agent?
Thanks a lot. Bob, would you like to get your word in here? And then I do apologize to Eric and Mike and Richard. Maybe we can get your issues on the table in the following session.
I have just a couple of miscellaneous thoughts. When I was a graduate student at Yale, I used to go into the stacks and pick up books of 10,000 pages called Nei Zheng Nian Jin and Cai Zheng Nian Jin, and I could open to any page and I would find Chapter 562, Article 4,621 of the law on such and so passed by the legislative yuan of the Republic of China. And it was all, you just blew the dust off the book, and it was the rule of law metastasized beyond your wildest dreams, and it was, of course, completely meaningless. And I wonder sometimes when I read the laws that now emanate in such fulsomeness from Chinese legal organizations or lawmaking bodies, whether we're into the same thing. And the second thing is just a certain skepticism about whether you can have the rule of law without consulting what the source of law is. Now, I realize the Japanese emperor gave them a constitution in 1890, and that the British king, the British royal throne, perhaps endowed Hong Kong with a legal system and so on. But really, can you look at the idea of having a rule of law in which you don't consult the sources of law? If the source of law is the Standing Committee of the Politburo, ultimately, how can we really talk about the rule of law as having some sort of tangible meaning here? So I'm not so sure it's easy to slice away the endless task of changing the political culture, which Jerry referred to as being this Sisyphean pushing of a rock uphill, from some notion of the introduction of rule of law. Makes me not very optimistic.
Gentlemen, would you care just to respond to all or some of those comments in a few minutes? All very good points, and we appreciate the questions.
Well, as to what that intelligent woman in the back said, I want to say, first of all, heaven is wonderful. The problem is how to get there. Second, I favor your political action methods of energizing the grassroots to increase their demands. But if you're going to do that, I better give you my card, because you may get locked up. Now, these are serious cases. I've had this happen. As to the impact of foreign direct investment, of course, it's had a very positive effect from July 1, 1979, when the first serious laws came out of the PRC after the Cultural Revolution to welcome foreign investment. And quite an impressive regime has been established in terms of norms, institutions, practices, informal assurances, dispute resolution, etc. And we've seen what foreign investment has become in China. But, of course, it would have become even more, especially financial investors, if the courts were allowed consistently to enforce contract expectations. They haven't been. Nevertheless, foreign investors love dictatorships. They like predictability. I used to work for 20 years for foreign investors in China. They want stable expectations, and you get those not under an Indian-type democratic rule where tomorrow the leftists may be in and you're thrown out or you don't know what will happen the next day. China is a reliable environment for foreign investors, and investors can't rely on international arbitration in China because that's like the courts. They obviously can't rely on the courts, but they can rely on informal settlements, guanxi. The Chinese like to give candy to every crying baby in the foreign investment field, and that's what's done so much to keep this thing, phenomenally important and successful thing, going. Who would have thought in 1979 China would rely so much on foreign direct investment as a source of capital compared to various alternatives? Having said all that, and having participated in that, the fact is it hasn't had much of an impact on the broader legal system. It hasn't really done much to enhance demands for institutional, judicial, arbitration, autonomy, etc. And we have to say China is a model. If I were running a developing country and I were in power and I wanted to stay in power the rest of my life, I'd look at the Chinese model, because it would assure me political control and it would assure foreign economic cooperation. One final point. A real rule of law relies on an independent legal profession as well as independent court. Lawyers are under attack today. They go to jail, they're prosecuted, and now there are some new rules that say in any case having over 10 people as a party to the case, these so-called mass litigations that China is afraid of, lawyers are under strict control with a duty to report not only to their client, but they're supposed to report everything they learn from their client to the public security people and the prosecutor and others in the government. And they're supposed to be representing the government as well as the people and bring the people together with the government. They're compromisers, mediators. They're returning to the role of state legal workers they were when they were first revived in 1980. Law professors are also under attack. Any law professor who takes part actively in cases in China involving controversy is in danger of losing his job. Also, even if they hang on to their job because people are watching to see whether they're going to be fired, they suffer other sanctions. You want to go to America to spend a year studying? You may not get the exit permit to go. There are all kinds of... And finally, we all know a free press is critical. There can be no rule of law system with or without one-party rule unless the press is free. It's absolutely critical to a genuine rule of law. Is the party willing to allow that? There are one-party states that have quite free presses, although Japan, again, is an example where the press doesn't feel itself free because of informal traditions and controls to publish everything until it's been published in the Washington Post or the New York Times.
So the this development in China, what I talked and also Penwei talked about are the progress for sure, but is that enough? Far from enough, and also far from what the rule of law eventually requires. So those are the first step, and that step should be pushed forward toward more open and democratization in China. In fact, when I talked to Pan Wei, even himself, very recently, he has been complaining that Liu Kang's in Beijing now is in a defensive and a minority position. Liberals, those kind of pushing for further change, and also for those kind of individual legal case, as Jeremy talked about, has been very, very popular among the Chinese intellectuals and also societies. So the change in China, I think, will be toward the direction eventually to open up.
Well, this has been an excellent opening session. It's laid out a lot of fantastic issues. We've seen already the schisms that occur and the differences of opinion that we can see. I think it's been a great framework laying out the big picture issues we need to think about today. We'll take a very short break, 10 minutes. We'll return with Stan Rosen and Professor Shi Tianjin, and later with Carl Minzner.
We start our second panel discussion. The first panel went really well, and the second panel we have two distinguished scholars on democracy in China. So this panel will discuss the prospects of democratization in China. We have Professor Stanley Rosen, the director of Center for East Asian Studies at University of Southern California. He will start first. Then we have Professor Tianjin Shi at Duke University. Poli Sci will be the second speaker. So let's have Dr. Rosen. Please, Dr. Rosen.
Thank you very much, and you may have to monitor my time a bit. Okay.
Okay, still 15 minutes.
essentially, Pan Wei's essay and the responses in the book represent a continuation of a debate that's been going on, in fact, several different debates that have been going on for many years. Professor Zhao Shui-Sheng, in fact, had a book about 5-6 years ago with a very similar title to the one that he's promoting now, over a number of questions. First question being whether the values and attitudes of ordinary people in China are compatible with the behavior necessary for a liberal democracy to evolve. And Shi Tianjin has written a lot on this. Andy Nathan's written a lot on this as well. Second question, if such a democratic breakthrough is to occur, would it more likely come from the top, from kind of an elite mobilization model with heroic leaders, to use Pan Wei's term? I'm sure Tianjin again talks about this as well. It's interesting that in Shi Tianjin's work, he cites Zhang Jinghua and Chiang Kai-shek as heroic leaders in Taiwan, but Pan, of course, is looking more at Deng Xiaoping and Jiang Zemin as possible leaders as a model. Or would it come from the bottom up, which occurred, of course, in 1989 and can be seen in the kind of people that Jerome Cohn is talking about, the lawyers and activists today, if this breakthrough were to come. A third question, how serious actually is the problem of governance that China faces today? How much of a crisis actually exists? It's very clear in Pan Wei's article, the most urgent need of China society is to curb corruption in a market economy. He says he sees no other alternative other than a rule of law regime, with the possible exception that the decision makers may not want substantial political reform at all, which he says is not really an alternative. Well, I certainly would argue that, in fact, that's the most likely alternative, the continuation of the status quo. Pan then notes his greatest fear. He says a pure democracy may rise as a result of inaction, a general collapse followed by a popular dictatorship. This fear of the masses view that comes out in this article also represents a continuing theme in the views of Chinese intellectuals towards state-society relations. If there were time, I could go into the whole debate in 1988, 1989 over the neo-authoritarian model versus the more rapid democratization model that was debated so much in China. back then as well, there was this desire for heroic leaders or strongmen, with Zhao Ziyang as the model, to reform Chinese politics. So this is very much a recurring issue. Pan Wei's arguments are not new in some ways, except his emphasis on the rule of law. But this argument about how to save China and avoid the masses is a very common one. Now, the issue of crisis and its current seriousness also divides scholars who write about China's transition. Yang Dali, for example, looks at recent incremental administrative forms, legal reforms, in the same way that Zhao Xuesheng does in many ways, as having improved the efficiency, the transparency, and accountability of the administrative state and helped bridge the gap between the state, between the elite and the masses, state and society. And also, he argues that this goes some way toward curbing the rampant corruption that everybody's so concerned about. So he sees a soft authoritarian administrative procedural reform system of a non-democratic nature as gradually reducing this gap that exists between state and society. He doesn't see a crisis the way some others do. On the other hand, as Professor Cohen mentioned, Peng Min-Shin, in his book and his debate in Foreign Policy magazine, among other places, sees China locked in a trap transition. In this scenario, according to Peng Min-Shin, new socioeconomic elites have been successfully co-opted by the party state. They become willing partners in a corrupt system of crony capitalism. And as Professor Cohen also said, why then should any of the winners of this system alter the status quo? It's a very compelling question. Peng Min-Shin agrees with Pan Wei and Xu Tianzhen in the sense that visionary reformers would be needed. He just doesn't see the emergence taking place. Pan Wei as well is very weak, it seems to me, on this point, noting that it might be done largely because there's no alternative except this dangerous pure democracy followed by a popular dictatorship. To me, this is the very familiar Cultural Revolution syndrome for Chinese intellectuals of a certain age, the fear of this kind of chaos that would come from mass democracy. For Peng Min-Shin as well, he finds the current situation unsustainable, noting that it's hard to imagine that China can evolve into a market economy without a cataclysmic mid-course correction. Now, Pan Wei, of course, is not advocating a market democracy, only a market rule of law, but some of the same principles would apply. To me, Pan's article is far more interesting and far more useful as a critique of what he calls blind democratization than as any kind of practical roadmap on how it could be implemented. It's also very useful because much of what he suggests, I think, resonates very well with many people in China. There's a strong antipathy to corruption. There's a concern with political stability. There's a rather high level of trust toward the central leaders and a fear of the kind of political instability which might translate into a fear of democratization through elections. But I think Pan Wei in his argument can be criticized in several very important areas, including certainly his understanding of the Hong Kong, the Singaporean, and the Japanese models and their suitability for China. Ed Friedman does this in the book. Other people have done this in other places. There was a Wilson Center meeting in March 2006 at which the issue also was discussed. But for me, the largest effect in Pan Wei's argument is his limited discussion of the process of implementation, the nature of politics in China, particularly the nature of central local relations and political leadership. His article is surprisingly apolitical, maybe not surprisingly since he's writing and lives in China. He elaborates five steps to reaching his goal, which in the end would be the consultative rule of royal regime and how it would be established, and how the law instead of the party would represent the supreme authority in China. According to Pan Wei's formulation, in the end, the Communist Party would only nominally lead via its members inside a neutral, honest, and law-abiding civil service, which would appear like Singapore's People's Action Party. The Communist Party leader would become a symbol of neutrality and social unity. Now, in passing, I would note, because I think it's important, that in the very next sentence he writes, although our Western friends would be reluctant to accept even the nominal leadership of the Communist Party in China, if the party could do this, this new rule of law regime would enjoy very high prestige among the Chinese people. And the reason I bring this up is because Pan is very representative of many well-educated, even Western-trained intellectuals in China who are highly suspicious of Western motives in advocating political change for China. If there were time, I would bring up the argument that Zhou Yongming makes in his in his book and other places on Chinese online politics on the internet, his recent book that just came out, because he talks about this notion of reception context and why well-educated, why well-informed young Chinese are very skeptical about the information conveyed by the Western media. As far as he's concerned, it's not a question of censorship in China. It's not a question of the information people are getting. It's a question of the context they have for interpreting information. And for Zhou Yongming, he says, this pursuit of national interest has kind of dominated as a paradigm in intellectual discourse. So anything that comes in from the West, including the advocation of the rule of law or democratization, is interpreted as somehow being used to further Western interests. And until that context, that reception context, can be changed, it's not likely to be successful in convincing Chinese intellectuals. A lot more could be said about that. But I think I want to spend most of the rest of my time saying a few things about the difficulty of implementation and the relationship with central-local relations and the nuts and bolts of contemporary Chinese politics that I think Pan Wei deliberately chooses to ignore. One can see this certainly in the way advocates and lawyers are treated by local officials. And most recently, you can see this in the controls over township and county-level elections for the 2 million seats on local people's congresses, which recently took place. Although there's a great deal of apathy about these people's congress elections at the local level, when dissidents, when activists engage in any kind of high-profile campaigns, the government quickly becomes alarmed. Let me take just one recent example. Members of a group of activists call themselves the Pan Blue Alliance after Taiwan. And, of course, as soon as they began participating and trying to mobilize voters, they were detained. This is going to happen over and over again. Sheng Huaren, a vice chairman of the National People's Congress, recently wrote in the party journal, Choshi, Seeking Truth, about the danger of infiltration by foreign powers and disgruntled groups. He stressed that grassroots democracy had to be conducted under the control of the Communist Party and that candidates had to be carefully screened by officials. He said that, of course, in-depth conflicts and problems in society and the economy are outstanding, and they'll be reflected in this round of elections. He said, that's for sure. But, he said, at the same time, Western hostile forces are stepping up their conspiracy to westernize and divide us and make a big fuss out of questions such as democracy and human rights. They're trying to find leeway for infiltration in the grassroots elections. So I think given such views, which are quite widespread among many in the elite in China and political elite and widely publicized, Pan Wei has done well to couch his call for rule of law regime in the same context as this rejection of the Western system of elections. He's advocating something acceptable. He's trying to revive the power and authority of the Chinese Communist Party. And if you look at surveys, recent surveys, I've collected some of them, I'm sure Xu Tianzhen has some as well, they show the authority of the party, the prestige of the party in decline, even among officials. I brought one with me, an internal survey of local officials attending classes at a provincial party school. When they were asked about the party's reputation and prestige among the masses, only 8% said it was still very high, with the majority saying it's getting weaker and weaker and not very high at all. So there is a real need, I think, to revive this authority of the Communist Party. But to understand the obstacles to implementation, you have to look at what the center expects from the local levels. There's a lot that's been written about this. Susan Shirk, more than 10 years ago, did a rational choice analysis on how the center plays to the provinces, how China has what she calls a selectorate, not an electorate. But I think Tony Saich summed it up very well in an anecdote he gave from one of his field trips when he directed the Ford Foundation in Beijing. I'll just go over that very quickly. He said a party secretary from an industrial town that he visited told Saich that he privatized virtually all of the local industry. Tony responded that the secretary appeared to be in breach of a central party policy that ruled out the use of the word privatization. The local official, in turn, criticized Saich for exhibiting such a limited understanding of Chinese Communist Party principles. He explained that the basic principle of party work was to rally around Comrade Jiang Zemin to ensure social stability. If he did not privatize the SOEs under his jurisdiction, he would be faced with a financial crisis that would lead to social unrest. Thus, far from contradicting party policy, the privatization policy was perfectly attuned to it. Now, in this case, I think it's an important one, in this case, the local official was innovating by promoting privatization, which theoretically he shouldn't have been doing. But the key phrase is he was supporting the central leadership, that's Susan Shirk's notion of the selectorate in the provinces, to ensure social stability. The central state will allow local interests to dictate strategies based on a perceived fear of social unrest. The key question here is when and under what conditions will the central state interfere with the local state? And if Panway's long-term process of five-step implementation were to begin, that's a big if, one can easily conceive of a variety of scenarios in which it would be called off long before achieving success. At the first sign of local officials warning the center that these early stages of reform were already damaging social stability and threatening the rule of the Chinese Communist Party, the reforms would be rolled back. There may be a fig leaf saying we're temporarily suspending some of these reforms in the official statements, but they would be postponed in the same way as some of the earlier attempts at political reform of Deng Xiaoping were put on hold, not to mention some of the initiatives of Zhao Ziyang. And you presumably already see this in the local concerns influencing the center's decisions in these very heavy-handed legal cases Professor Cohn talked about, brought against lawyers, brought against activists, and so on. Because the localities have convinced the center that all this legal action going on is leading to social unrest. Therefore, even though the center may want to go ahead with some of this and may not want to see blind lawyers being brutalized, they realize, from their point of view, social unrest is the bigger danger than international criticism. Now, what about the desire for ordinary Chinese citizens for democratization? Again, a lot's been written about this, and there's certainly a desire to believe that it's true. In this volume, Ed Friedman says that his conversations in China make him believe that there's a deep yearning among the Chinese people, often just below the surface, for the blessings of democracy. You see this also with the recent Supergirl phenomenon, the way it's been interpreted in the West and debated in China as a nascent and highly popular form of democracy. Those of you may be familiar with the imitation of American Idol in China. The New York Times Magazine, at the end of an article on the internet, said about the Supergirl competition, in each round, viewers could vote for their favorite competitor via text message from their mobile phones. As the season ran its course, it began to resemble a presidential election campaign, with delirious fans setting up websites urging voters to pick their favorite singer. In the final episode, 8 million young Chinese used their mobile phones to vote. The winner was Li Yuchun, a 21-year-old who dressed like a schoolgirl and sang Zombie by the Irish band The Cranberries. If you think about a practice for democracy, this is it, said Li Kaifu, the head of Google's Beijing office. People voted for Supergirls. They loved it. They went out and campaigned. It may not be a revolution, but it might be a start. And the way it was interpreted in places like the New York Times, the Chinese get to vote, if only for Supergirl. Well, there may be some good reasoning behind this argument. For example, certainly the authorities at times interpreted it as an example of the disadvantages of elections. China Daily asked, how come an imitation of a democratic system ends up selecting the singer who has the least ability to carry a tune? I mean, the message is clear. Clearly, democracy and elections don't work. Another example of that, so I study Chinese film and the film industry. The recent film V for Vendetta was banned in China, the Warner Brothers film. I have a lot of friends in Warner Brothers. It was banned for public showing in China. But there was a very popular Chinese film magazine right at the time it was banned, included a very interesting poster in there. And this is widely circulated in China. V for Vendetta, it says at the top, people should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people. Okay, now what does that mean? Is it sarcasm? Is it subversion? Is it a yearning for democracy? Okay, the last point, because I know time is running short. Tang Wenfang's book, recent book, Public Opinion and Political Change in China, has some very interesting survey data, and I want to just go over one very quickly, because it shows the kind of mixed picture you have in China toward democratization. In one six-city 1999 survey where the measurement was of conservatism in China, he found the following responses to questions relating to democracy, showing both a conservative and a liberal tendency in China. He said the results were mixed, as to how politically conservative urban residents in China were. In the seven questions, we found on the conservative side, the majority of respondents showed political obedience and opposed democratization. On the liberal side, the majority of the respondents supported selecting government through elections, disapproved of government efforts to control political dissidents, and disagreed with the statement that only the government can fully represent the country. The respondents were split on whether the government should promote freedom of speech and social diversity. And, for example, on the question, people should obey government decisions regarding state affairs. Do you agree or disagree? 70% agreed that people should obey government decisions regarding state affairs. On the question, the most important condition for our country's progress is political stability. Democratization under the current conditions would only lead to chaos. 59% agreed, 27% disagreed. But on the question, elections are not important as long as government policy reflects public opinion, 58% disagreed, only 34% agreed. So you have a very mixed picture in terms of public attitudes. But I think, as many people, Panway included, have suggested, that public attitudes are less important than elite attitudes. And I would agree with Professor Cohn more than Professor Zhao at this point that right now it's too risky, or at least perceived as too risky, for the political elite to risk the power they have when things seem to be going so well and everybody's desperate to get to China to make money. Why rock the boat? Thank you.
Thank you. So now we have Professor Shi Tianjian, is a high-tech person, so he's using a computer.
So let me make it work first. So how do I turn it on? So I'm going to talk about the group of the people who are not that important. That is the public, the general public. In China. And the issue I debate, at the center of scholar debate, is that most scholars see growing disconnect between China's market-oriented economy with its authoritarian political institution. And the people debate about the possibility for the authoritarian society with a market economy, can the regime last or sustain. And there are four basic arguments about the future of China which dominate the scholarly community. The first one is China is going to collapse. And many of people are familiar with Gordon Chang's argument. I'm not going to give you detail. And the second one is that China will democratize. And the basic argument is that opposition are too weak to launch a bottom revolution. And if we incorporate this idea with the recent scholarship about democratization by Charles Boyce, which argues that only when leaders see there's no danger for them, they will democratize. And this is compatible to that argument. And therefore, Bruce argues that top-down transformation is possible. And the third one, which is given by Andy Nathan, he basically argues that the authoritarianism can last in China. And the reason is that the CCP has the ability to sustain popular support through the combination of economic growth, skillful repression and the propaganda, as well as the foreign policy success, which can generate nationalism among the people, which trapped the idea of the desire for democratization. And the last one, which many people here already mentioned, a friend of us, Pei Minxin, talked about China will gradually decay because the institution barrier prevents China from the necessary transition and the bureaucrats become predator. But the situation would last. If we look at the similarity and difference, the first similarity is that probably democratization in China is unavoidable. But the only issue is that if China refuses to democratize, either the people will revolt or the system will decay. So if that is the case, the you know, people ask what kind of a regime China need. Here we see the difference. And most people would say what China need is a liberal democracy, and Pan Wei made the argument that what China need is a consultative rule of law regime. Probably the democracy should be a long-term goal, but in the foreseeable the future, the rule of law is more likely. And there is a, if we really look at the argument, there is a missing link. That is, what do ordinary people in China like? So many people, when they talk about democracy versus rule of law, they usually argue that Chinese people, like any other people in the world, they lack democracy. We may say, okay, this argument could be right. But at the current stage, when democracy becomes the only game in town, if I use Larry Diamond word. So he argues even the most authoritarian society in the world claim that they are some kind of democracy. And the problem becomes whether or not the regime can successfully persuade people that what they enjoy is some kind of democracy. So here, I think this is an empirical question rather than the theoretical question. So what I present here is the data from the Asian Barometer Survey, which we talk about. The theme of the survey is democracy. So the first question we ask is that whether democracy is suitable for the society in which the respondent resides. And the number here are the mean value. We gave them from 1 to 10 scale. 1 means totalitarian, and 10 means democracy. So, you know, how democracy is suitable for China. So if we look at this picture, probably it's very promising. The mean value for mainland China is 8.46, which means majority of people in China want democracy. But remember, when we talk about the transition, we cannot only look at the demand side, that is, you know, how much do you love democracy? But there is another issue, which is the supply side. That is, how do they see the situation of the current system? Then we ask people a second question. That is, give us your evaluation of the current level of democracy you enjoy in your country or region, since we have Hong Kong and Taiwan, to be politically correct. Well, what you see is that mysteriously, the mainland China has a mean value of 7.22, which is quite high. So if we look at all those societies, all of the other countries are some kind of democracy or liberal state, probably. Hong Kong is not a democracy, but a liberal state. And China, the people gave the score of the current affair, or current state of democratic development, a 7.22, which is quite high. So then we can look at the discrepancy between the supply and demand. So this is what you want. This is what you get. So how large the gap would definitely influence probably the probability for the transition. And we see again a picture which is quite interesting, at least. First of all, the people in Hong Kong, they gave the highest gap they show. And then Mongolia and mainland China. And for Taiwan, the population see the supply of democracy exceed their demand. So then we ask, how comes this is possible? Right? How comes this is possible? Look at the chart, the figure. So how can we, what are the explanations? How many minutes do I have?
You still have 5 minutes.
Okay. So empirical findings summarize people in China want democracy, but the perceived level of democracy in China is extremely high. And the unexpected finding, which I already show. So puzzle. So when we have a puzzle, we give a hypothesis. We try to explain the puzzle. So we have three, probably, the possible interpretation. The first one is, of course, political fear. People in China dare not to speak out their opinion. And the second one is that the political indoctrination or successful of political mobilization. And the third one could be people in China understand democracy in a different way as compared to what we understand the meaning of democracy. So let's talk about the first possibility, the political fear. So in the survey, we asked people to give us their evaluation. By the way, this survey is done in 2002. We asked people to give us the evaluation of, you know, in different areas. Civil liberty, political rights, economic performance, corruption, social order. I was surprised by this finding. In terms of freedom of expression, 85% people say it's better. Freedom of residence, 82%. Freedom of religion, 75%. Freedom of association, 74%. The political right is not as high as the civil liberty. The personal political right, 69% people say better. Independent legal system, 61% people think it is better. And the equal treatment by the government, 60%. And but influence of the government policy, only 39%. But then you may say, because people are so fear about expression, what they gave you is what government wants you to say, want us to say. But if that is the case, we should find the answer tilled, all the questions tilled to one side. But then when we look at the inequality. You see, 74% people say the situation become worse. And talk about the corruption, 83% people say worse. So in other words, probably political fear does not explain the So then, in order to understand, what do people mean when they say, yes, I want democracy? What do you mean by democracy? So we had an open-ended question to ask. Everybody talk about democracy. When we use the word democracy, tell us what does it mean. We ask the interviewer to prompt the respondent three times.
So that means each respondent can give us three answers in their understanding of democracy. So in China, 22% people think democracy means either freedom, equality, or what I can do whatever I want. But if you talk about election participation in the decision-making process, listen to people's opinion, you talk about 11% people describe democracy as election. But a lot of people, I would argue, they portray democracy means some kind of, I call it parental care. That is, you know, they specifically say democracy means when government make decision, they soliciting people's opinion or joint decision making, they consult us, or government for the people. When government make decision, they are for the people. Yes, people want democracy, but probably people want some kind of a different kind of democracy. But in political science, people would say, what about the E word? That is the endogenesis problem. Yes, people in China live in authoritarian society. They are not, they do not understand what democracy means. And they are indoctrinated by the regime. Therefore, you know, it's not people in China have a different view, which I would say this is the culture, probably, explanation. But this is the regime indoctrination that shaped a particular kind of understanding of democracy for people in China. So are there any way to test this hypothesis? The answer is yes. Why? We have Taiwan in the survey. So the same question, but remember Taiwan has a peculiar situation. So the same question is asked. That is my end. The same question is asked in Taiwan. So let's look at the data from Taiwan. So Taiwan had an election, had a multi-party system. So basically you find, first of all, more people in Taiwan think democracy in terms of freedom and equality, which I call the substantive democracy, than mainland China. But equally, less people, around the same number of Taiwan people, see democracy means election, electoral participation, and check and balance. And despite Taiwan had experienced democracy and had democratic institution, there are a substantial number of people there still believe democracy in some kind of parental care. So I don't have any time, you know, otherwise I can talk about the behavior consequence of this peculiar culture, but the conclusion is that at least there are broad social base in China that are compatible to what Pan Wei has argued. Last word, I'm trying to describe the opinion of people in China, so don't make me to the member of the new Kong. For a long time, I have been advocating that Chinese people want democracy, but you know, when we do a thorough research, we find something which is contrary to our expectation. Thanks.
Okay, thank you both. Professor Xu and Professor Zhu Shen, these two scholars have put the debate read in the book in a broad context of scholarly research and a debate on the rule of law and democratization in China. And now the floor is open. We have quite a few people, did not get time in last session to raise questions. And so now, questions?
Thank you. Wayne Mary, the American Foreign Policy Council. My background on China relates mostly to Russia's and China's mutual relationship. And one thing I'm conscious of in reading the literature on both sides and meeting with Chinese groups and talking to people in China is that they are very conscious of the Russian example, the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the perception that, unlike China, that Russia took a historically very wrong course, which led to collapse, instability, economic failure, and so on and so forth. But a secondary theme runs through this, which is what I would actually like members of the panel to address if they wish, that Russia is an example of a failure of Western, principally American, democracy advocates who went to Russia with a democratization agenda but largely ignorant of and often even indifferent to local context and conditions. And that therefore Russia is an example, and perhaps Iraq even more starkly, of why China should be very cautious about taking this kind of advice, not just because of all the issues that have been discussed this morning, but because while it may have been a successful process in some countries, in Eastern Europe and in other places in the world, in a number of cases it has not been and continues not to be. And that, therefore, if the Chinese are going to pursue democratization, they are better advised to do so at their own behest, defining it in their own terms, than to listen to Americans whose track record is to go into a country like Russia or Iraq with a democratization agenda, create chaos, and then walk away. I perhaps exaggerate slightly for purposes of illustration.
So we'll...
For letting me do this. Okay. That's, an interesting question. Ed Friedman, in his chapter in the book, addresses this in part by saying that Ed Conway completely misunderstands the Russian case in terms of, a number of aspects. One, the Russian case is often looked at as an example of Gorbachev's mistake of doing political reforms first instead of economic reforms. Whereas China did economic reforms first instead of political reforms. Friedman also refers to the fact that it's very convenient for Conway to look at the supposedly unsuccessful Russian model, but not look at the successful Eastern European models. So that's one way of looking at it. But I think one aspect of this in China, why the Russian case is looked at as a failure, partly a failure of Western efforts at democratization, but also just a failure more generally, is, and because I was in China at the time when the Russian state was collapsing, and a lot of friends of mine, intellectuals, told me at the time, this is going to have a major impact on China. You won't see it immediately, and there'll be repression at first, but this collapse of communism in the Soviet Union is of incredible importance to China. And then, of course, they went in the opposite direction when the Russian case proved to be less successful than they had hoped. And they, all those hopes were dashed, and those people who had been in charge of pursuing the repressive strategies against the contagion of the Russian model were able to gain the upper hand. So I think a lot has to do with the high expectations that existed at first, which I saw firsthand, as well as some of the other arguments that have been made.
Okay, more questions? Okay, Susan there, and then Eric.
I remember one of the things you said, Jerry, was that possibilities for change would be, one, either a strong leader who's bold enough to step out and democratize, and the other would be a desperate leadership. And I think in this whole conversation, the beast in the room is corruption. And that's what's undermining the legitimacy of the party, and the irreconcilable nature of democracy. And the party is less important. You can't keep the party, really, if you're going to have this corruption. Party's principles. So I'm thinking of that. I look at it, the leadership now, and I see it as desperate. So if you see the party's decision a few years ago saying, this is a matter of survival. Unless we make the party incorrupt, the party will not survive. And I actually don't see that that's changed any time since that decision was made. And any of their different ways of curing the situation haven't been resolved. So there were some people who wanted to try to democratize inside the party, to cure corruption by democratizing inside the boundary of the party, and that seems to have done absolutely nothing. So I'm wondering if you could tell me anything about that, whether corruption makes the whole discussion sort of academic. Because it seems that pushing democracy in China, we've gotten the long part of the way with all the laws that have been passed, and the rule of law is not the same as democracy, but I think the two definitely go together. But it feels like pushing a mass trying to get to go as fast as the speed of light, it gets harder and harder as you get closer to the speed of light. It almost now begins to seem impossible.
Okay, we take two questions at a time. That way we can save time. So, Eric, you have.
Eric McVaden, the Institute of Foreign Policy Analysis. It's dawned on me as I've listened to the conversation, some impressions. About 15 years ago, I guess most of my interlocutors in China, it seemed to me, were imparting, sometimes saying directly, that the party for them was largely a joke, maybe a bad joke. I no longer get that impression. I don't know how good my sample is, that somehow it has rejuvenated itself to at least the point where that doesn't seem to sneak into the conversation anymore. I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Okay.
I want to make sure to give Shortan Jen a chance, so let me do the second one, leave you the first one. Okay. I would agree with that assessment of the CCP. It used to be very commonly said, certainly by academics and even people in China, that not so much the party was a joke, but that the party could be bypassed. You could do whatever you wanted in China, and the party didn't get in the way because they were trying to restore legitimacy. They were very cautious in what they were doing. I think that's no longer the case, and you see this when I look at statistics on especially university students and the new elite, private entrepreneurs now about 33% or more of private entrepreneurs are party members. That's the heads, seeing Chieju, the heads of the private enterprises are party members. Joining the party helps you get ahead. If you look at surveys of university students as to whether they want to join the party, why they want to join the party, it's because it helps your future. So the party's not a joke. The party's important, not because anybody believes in communism, but because it's a source of upward mobility. And that was not the case in the years after 1989. The party was very careful who they recruited. They didn't want these university students or people of independent thought, because they felt that it would lead to this Hepingyanbian, this peaceful evolution. But now all that has changed, and there's a much higher level, I think, of, if you want to use the word, legitimacy for the party in spite of all the corruption. So I would tend to agree with that.
I want to answer the first question. I'm not that, despite, you know, the picture I present is not that optimistic, but in terms of evaluating the long-term possibility for change, I'm not that pessimistic for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that, you know, Jerry talked about the state, the level of change, possible change from the state level or from the society level. But there is another level we can look at, that is the intermediate level, that is the intermediate, the government official. Let me give you an anecdote. Example, you know, this year I went to Wenzhou to look at the appeal, the collective action. And when I arrived there, I saw a bunch of people, you know, demonstrate on the city government claiming that there's a corruption. And so I asked them, what is the issue? They say, okay, a piece of land, one mu of land, now sell about 30,000, and the government only gave us 10. So we want more. Well, then I went to the government, asked the official there, you know, what is your explanation of the situation? And they claim, yes, their charges are right. The only thing you miss is the timing. When we bought the land, it's in 1999. That, at that time, it's 10,000. And now, it's 30,000. So then I asked them, how do you deal with the situation? They say, in the past, we have dealt with those people for many times. In the past,
we try to buy them out. So give them more money and say, stop making appeal. But that only generates more desire for other people to make the similar appeal. So nowadays, yes, we may still give them money, but we ask them to sign a contract, say, this is the last time we will give you money. And then if they continue, since we have the legal document, we ask them to go to the court. So that is a sign of, I would say, the desire of rule of law caused by the structure change in the society, transition from the planned economy to the market economy. And I talked to some of the official at the central government, and many of them see this is a real possibility that the local official are forced by this dynamic to introduce some kind of rule of law. I understand Jerry talked a lot about the cases, the detained lawyer and so on and so forth. But at the same time, you know, there is a legal study survey done by Melanie Manning and Pierre Landry and Ken Jennings, and they found the use of court for administrative dispute had increased about 300 times over the past few years. Yes, in a high-profile case, we see the suppression, but at the societal level, we see a lot of. As to the rule of law or to the reform within the party democratization, we saw a lot of people talk about the democratization within the party. And the recent political reform, which we know in Vietnam, at least portrayed by the media as the direct election for the general secretary of the party, that stipulate a great interest among both the government official and the intellectuals. And people may say, okay, we may not do it at the societal level, so but why not learn from Vietnam?
Okay, for the time sake, we see the lunch is here, so we collect all the questions in that way. We can have everyone to talk. We start from Jeremy.
There is an invisible legal process in China in which the party plays the key roles. At one end of the spectrum is the action of the Party Commission on Discipline and Inspection. Before any criminal case involving an important party member, especially a corruption case, goes anywhere, before the criminal justice system and all its protections comes into effect, the party locks people up, according to the so-called Shuanggui, the two designations. And you could be in their hands incommunicado for a year, 2 years. There are really very few limits on what they can do to you. Then they'll make up their mind. You may get the loss of your party membership if you've been corrupt or a lesser sanction. And if so, if you're not at too high a level, you may then be processed by something called the Dangji Fating. That's for lower level party members, but it's a court. It's a kind of a party disciplinary tribunal. And many people can invoke their rights now, and they've imported judicial ideas into the party's very process in order to gain legitimacy in the eyes of the 70 million party members. You can also then get sent to the criminal justice system. That gives us the other end of the spectrum. When you go to court, you mentioned it's a good sign you've got middle-level court use. That's true, but what does it mean? Who decides in the court? If it's a case of any importance, not just criminal, the Zheng Fawei will decide, the political legal group will decide. Or the adjudication committee, Shenpan Wenhui, at the top, will be led by Yuan Zhang, who knows what the party wants because he's taking part in the Zhengfa Wei. So we have to ask, what do these words mean? And how should we even use words? Should we say a Shenpanyuan is an adjudication person? That sounds strange, but at least makes us think this isn't an ordinary Western-style judge. I mean, every word we use. So if we had perfect knowledge of how the system really functioned, and it might not be a bad system. There's no reason China has to ape the West. China should have its own system. But right now you have sort of formal structures and language and words, and then you have the way the system really works. And the question is, if you were leading the party, what changes would you want to make in this system?
Okay, so more questions? Is that everyone is hungry now? And Michael, you had a question earlier. Are you going to rest now? Okay. Another Michael.
Hi, Mike Pillsbury. I just wanted to add a question about the Soviet Union's experience. There are now four books that go over what ultimately became a violent debate in 1990, 1991, inside the Soviet Communist Party over politics, rule of law, definition of what they're up to. I wonder why so many contributors to your volume don't reference at all the Soviet experience. I was at the party school in Beijing last year, not my first visit, and whenever you talk with them about the democracy debate, it seems as though the Soviet experience is right at the tip of their fingers. They know about Khrushchev's and the KGB head and his claims that the CIA was behind all reformers. They know about Yakovlev's memoirs, the agony he went through in Canada, the Gorbachev visit to him. They seem to all talk. They, that is the party school people who talk about political reform, seem to have at the tip of their fingers the Soviet experience. Who did what on Tuesday at 4 p.m.? Why Yeltsin was able to defend the White House? What George Bush said that was not helpful the morning of the coup? They seem to talk this way among themselves. Why then devote so much attention to Pan Wei, who may only be one in a range of internal party figures debating reform? Why simply ignore this 1990-1991 experience, which seems to be so rich to the senior party school people themselves? That's my question, meant as a criticism, I'm sorry to say.
Any more questions? Okay, so that question is for me. So I will very briefly to answer. I think Mike has a very good point. I think from my talking to Chinese elites and the Chinese government officials, the Soviet case has been a negative case, especially in the early 1990s. And also the Taiwan case now becomes a very negative. See all this chaos in China. Although there is a positive side, I mean, people can protest to try to force the president to come out of office. But on the other hand, they see the negative and chaotic side. The Soviet case is very similar. They see those kind of disintegration of the empire and the chaos, economic decay or economic growth is not as good as in China. China has, from their side, the legitimacy of the communist government is based on two things. One is performance, economic performance. Second, nationalism. External relations defend China's national interests and national pride. And the Communist Party of China has done well in China for both sides without democracy. So the Soviet case, in that case, is a negative case. Why we have not talked about that? That will be another book. We hope Michael would write for sure next year. And the Pan Wei case is a different type. I mean, Pan Wei's debate is from a different perspective, from a Chinese scholar's perspective, to try to make argument from the Chinese, from his perspective, Chinese culture, Chinese tradition, which has been deep-rooted among not Chinese thinking, although he's regarded as a Liu Kang in China, just not, I don't know, in Washington, Liu Kang is in White House, in office, but in China, they are not in the Zhongnanhai yet. I don't know if Pan Wei's view has been that powerful in Zhongnanhai, but it's a intellectual debate. So that's why they spoke. And you want response to other questions?
let me just make one point relating to what Shir Tian, even though it hasn't been asked, what Shir Tianjin talked about in terms of political culture and understanding of democratization in China. Both of us know this early survey that was done by Min Qi, where he attempted to replicate American studies of democratization, people's attitudes, the Verbenau-Petrosek study. And some of it was very striking in spite of methodological problems. One thing that struck me, one question they asked was based on the Verbenau-Petrosek study in the U.S. and elsewhere. They had the statement, I disagree with what you're saying, but I would defend to the death your right to say it. And when they disaggregated the data, whether it was elite intellectuals, academics with university education, poor peasants, party officials, more than 50% of each of those samples had no idea what that meant. And they said, why would I defend to the death the right of somebody to say something which I disagree with? Do you mean we should bring back the Gang of Four? It's a complete different understanding of through the socialization process, political culture process, of what democratization means. It's a much more instrumental, practical thing, at least at the level of articulation. Because in the U.S. as well, when you do surveys on the Bill of Rights and you don't tell them what's the Bill of Rights, a lot of people will oppose it very strongly.
Okay, so finally, I would like to take this opportunity to thank Dr. Beth Gill, the firm chair in China Studies, GSIS, for putting together such a wonderful event. This event is not only to promote the book in the back side, for sure, if you are interested, you can buy that book there, but shows it is a real debate. It's a very important issue in both Beijing and Washington. People are interested. Thank you all for coming, and thank all the presenters. They have done a really good job. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Sam. While lunch is here, I'll invite everyone to take 10 or 15 minutes to grab a plate and sit back down and enjoy conversation with your colleagues, and we'll, in just a short time after that, be led in discussion by Carl Minzner. As I announced at the earlier stage of our conference this morning, unfortunately, Dennis Wilder, the Senior Director for Asian Affairs at the White House, was literally almost at the very last minute called to join the President in New York for the UN General Assembly opening. But in any event, please do grab a bite, and we'll reconvene, say, 10 minutes or so. Thanks very much. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've all had a chance to get a bite to eat, and we'll, if I may, turn from food to some food for thought, I guess we'd say. We're very, very fortunate today to have been able to secure the input and insights of a rising star, I should say, in this field, a person who's devoted a great deal of time to these issues, both in China and in the United States. This is Carl Minzner, of course. I don't know. I'm sure he's familiar to many, many of you. It's been my fortunate experience to know Carl now for a couple of years, especially in relation to his work at the Congressional Executive Commission on China. I'm sure all of you are aware that this commission formed, I think, about 4 or 5 years ago, which emerged, I should say, sort of out of the closure of the annual permanent normal trade relations a debate in China, which had been an annual opportunity for members of Congress to express their concerns about China's human rights record, as well as on a host of other bilateral issues of concern. And as a result of the closure of that discussion, this commission was formed precisely to allow members of Congress, as well as members of the executive branch, to consult together and to carry out some very, very serious research and analysis about questions of human rights, rule of law, democratization, religious freedom, media censorship, and other very, very important questions that we're talking about here today. I think the commission has done a spectacular job in its work, and I think primarily because of people like Carl Minzner, who are brought on board as full-time staff and as general counsel and bring Chinese language capability, a very deep grounding in the academic training, both in law, in international relations and other related fields, and a genuine commitment, I think, to assuring that our country does as best job as it possibly can to analyze these issues and make sure that our policymakers and our public understand them and take appropriate measures through the policy process in response, all, I think, with the aim of helping foster in China a social and political system which is more just, is more fair, is more equitable, and is more responsive to its citizens. Carl has worked for the past 3 years at the Commission as a senior counsel and focusing on issues such as local governance, civil society, access to justice, internal migration questions, as well as issues related to sources of internal discontent in China. Last Friday was his last day at the Commission. He begins, as of today, officially speaking, as a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs Fellow, a very prestigious opportunity for him to pursue some very serious research on important questions related to human rights and the rule of law and domestic unrest over the course of the next year. And we were very fortunate that Carl wanted to spend the first part of his fellowship here at CSIS and help us understand these issues more carefully as well. So I think we're in for a real treat. We've got a real expert, a person who's been looking at these issues extremely carefully and, interestingly, doing so up on Capitol Hill. And we're hoping not only can he inform us on his take on these questions, but also help us understand a little better how these issues are being understood up on Capitol Hill and within the executive branch as well. So as we all do in Washington, we like to turn from the issue itself into the so what question and understand a little bit better about what our response ought to be going forward. And I think we will not be disappointed in hearing what Carl has to say about that. So please join me in welcoming Carl Mintzmyer.
Thank you very much, Bates. As Bates mentioned, this is indeed my first day on the job here at CSIS. And when he asked me last Friday to give this talk, I was particularly honored to be associated with individuals such as distinguished as Professor Zhao, Professor Shi, Professor Rosen, and Professor Cohen. I'm also very happy to have this opportunity to talk. As Bates mentioned, I've been working on issues of rule of law and democratic governance for the Commission for the last 3 years. I'd just like to make 2 points and then open the floor up for discussion, particularly opening up the floor for discussion on the so what question that Bates mentioned earlier. The first point that I'd like to make is that regardless of whether you have on a theoretical level, if your interest is in the broader issue of protecting citizens' rights and political liberalization in China, or whether your interest is in the more narrow question of how to assure that China's governance is improved and operated in accordance with rule of law norms, these all come down in practice to one core practical problem. And this is the excessive concentration of power in the hands of local party elites and the absence of any independent checks on their authority. That's the first point. The second point that I'd like to make is that although Chinese leaders have themselves taken some steps to address this problem over the last 15 or 20 years, they have not really grappled with the core of the problem. And this is not only blocking the broader goal of, or the broader topic of political liberalization, it is actually undermining their own efforts to create a modern legal system and use rule of law norms to improve their governance of society. First, let me just go with state the obvious. The Chinese political system at the very local level is marked by an excessive concentration of power in the hands of one person. This person is the township or the county party secretary. In Chinese, it's the ibasho. In English, I just like to think of him as the head honcho. This person, he and people closely linked to him, control exercise significant, if not total, control over all of the formal levers of politics in local government. This includes control over appointments to key government positions. This includes control over finance, and this includes significant control over media and information. Now, if your goal is the broader one of expanding citizen rights and allowing people to enjoy access to input into the political decisions that affect their lives, then you need to figure out ways to check the power of this individual. I don't think I need to give any of you sort of concrete examples of that. That's pretty obvious. But even if your goal is the more narrow one of just assuring that government is run in a functional, stable, non-corrupt way according to law, then you also have to deal with the question of how to assure that the rules of the game in that local jurisdiction are not simply the personal whim of that individual party secretary, but rather are national law. Now, let me give you a couple examples of that last point, how the excessive control or the excessive centralization of power in the hands of local party officials actually create significant governance problems that the Chinese leaders, central leaders, would like to address. Take land seizures, for example. Chinese officials perceive that growing social unrest generated by illegal land seizures poses significant challenges to their controls over society. Central officials would certainly like to assure that when local officials take villagers' land for development projects, they abide by national legal standards for providing compensation. However, the lack of effective checks on the power of local party officials means that many of them can take advantage of the relatively weak property rights regime that faces Chinese citizens, transfer land from villagers to developers with whom the party officials have good connections, and the citizens, the villagers themselves, get inadequate compensation, generating public protest. Environmental pollution is another example. Chinese officials would certainly like to assure that local officials abide by national environmental standards when it comes to approving and new industrial projects. Yet they would also like to head off large-scale environmental disasters such as the Songhua River catastrophe of last year, and they would like to head off social unrest such as the protests in Zhejiang that erupted last summer as well because of pollution of farmland and people's homes. Yet all of these national efforts are undermined by the ability of local party officials to use their unchallenged local political status to strike protectionist deals with local industry and allow them to evade national environmental standards. Similarly, local officials can use this centralized power that they enjoy to choke off information to top-level officials. So, for example, in the Songhua River disaster of last year, local officials simply barred the media and other local government bureaus from reporting on the fact that there was a massive benzene leak going down the Songhua River towards Russia. It took about a week before the central government even learned of it, led to a massive delay in the ability of central officials to respond. So regardless of the question of whether or not your goal is to figure out broader interests of political liberalization or whether your interest is in the very specific question of how to improve local governance, you're still confronted with the very same practical problem at the base, which is this arbitrary exercise of power of local party officials because they have very strong controls over all local political power. Now, the good news is that Chinese officials themselves sort of recognize that this is a problem. Then they recognize that this creates trouble for their own efforts to govern society. And they've made some efforts over the last 15 or 20 years to check it. Authorities have allowed the creation of an administrative legal regime which permits citizens to bring administrative challenges against government actions they deem illegal. They have allowed the development of certain mechanisms, certain bottom-up electoral mechanisms, which allow citizens to participate in the selection of local officials, such as the village elections that Professor Shi has examined, and certain forms of local party elections since the late 1990s. Authorities have also allowed the development of institutions such as local people's congresses and civil society groups that allow a somewhat greater ability for citizens to participate politically. Now, the catch, or the bad news, is that the Chinese authorities themselves have systematically limited all of the things I just discussed whenever it comes, whenever they perceive that it might call into question the core issue of centralized party control. Chinese officials have clamped down on the efforts by local officials to expand the scope and the scale of elections. They have required local party secretaries at the village and the county level to head the local people's congresses, to serve as the head of the local people's congress, thus ensuring that these organizations do not emerge as threats to their control. And they continue to apply a relatively restrictive regulatory regime for civil society organizations, which requires them to have a government or party sponsor in order to register. All of these are political checks which prevent the emergence of any sort of organized opposition. But these controls, these types of, this emphasis on centralized party control extends to the legal system as well. Local party officials continue to enjoy a say over the judges who serve within their areas. The Chinese media itself has reported on the phenomena of local party officials issuing those red-hatted documents, the Hongtou Wenjian, which barring courts from hearing particular cases that they themselves deem sensitive. And as Jerry mentioned, officials have recently made much more significant efforts to clamp down on lawyers who themselves have attempted to use the legal system aggressively to bring challenges to government action on behalf of folks who have suffered grievances. Now, naturally, this unchecked power of local party officials blocks any move towards political liberalization. That's pretty obvious. But it also undermines the state's own interest in attempting to develop a modern legal system and rule of law norms in order to govern society. Take the administrative law system, for example. When introduced in the form of the administrative litigation law in 1989, Chinese officials touted this as a new rubric, a new way to resolve state-society tensions, a new way to resolve citizen grievances against the state. It hasn't worked out that way. Total numbers of administrative cases went up to about 100,000 in the mid-1990s, and since about 1998, they've actually been declining. Similar phenomena is existent within the civil legal system as well. The total number of cases handled by the Chinese courts this year, this past year, is about 4 million. That's about the same number that was handled in 1995. So rapid economic change, lots of grievances, lots of problems in societies, but citizens themselves aren't aggressively using these channels to try to defend their interests, or there's been no significant increase in citizen efforts to use these channels to defend their interests. And it makes sense. If you perceive that the legal system is interpenetrated by party control, particularly of the officials who run your local area, then it's not necessarily clear that it's a rational choice for you to rely on these institutions to try to protect your interests. At least it's not clear that it offers you any better response. As a result, instead of the steady growth of a mature legal system and the rule of law norms, you're seeing a growing pervasive discontent with the legal system among Chinese citizens and an increased rise in the number of mass protests and mass incidents as citizens take their grievances outside of the legal system and attempt to resolve it through other channels. So where does this leave us? Well, I'll just leave you with sort of two thoughts, and then I'll be happy to respond to the so what question that Bates threw out. First, it may mean that regardless of how you phrase the question, whether the question is democratization, political liberalization, better protection of citizen rights, rule of law norms, there's one big elephant in the room that you have to figure out how to address first, or whether even the question is to how to ensure a stable society for China, a stable future for China. It may be that the key question that you have to address first is, what are you going to do about that excessive concentration of power in the hands of local party officials and the absence of independent checks on their authority? Second, it may mean that there is an important point that we should grasp, particularly for the sake of talking with the Chinese government, which is that the political controls that the Chinese state is attempting to impose to maintain control of the political system is actually undermining their own effort to develop rule of law norms in China. And with that, I will stop and take questions. Jared.
You're an expert on the so-called Xinfang procedures.
Yes.
Could you tell us, in light of your study, what is Xinfang? Where does it relate to the rule of law? How successful is it? And what reflections have you as a result of your study?
Great. Jerry, Jerry gives great questions because I'm actually going to be in tomorrow. I'm actually going to be at NYU talking at his class on this subject. So he's throwing me a softball question to begin with. First, let me just, for all of those who don't know, that the Xinfang system is the Chinese letters and visits system. I've got an article out on the subject. It's the Chinese petitioning system, and it's essentially a way for citizens, for those of you who've spent lots of time in China, I'm sure you've seen it in one form or another, it's basically aggrieved citizens attempting to present their grievances to central party officials. There are Xinfang bureaus associated with the party committee and government at all levels within Chinese society, at all levels of Chinese government, and even within the courts. It's a carryover from the imperial system, where petitioning the emperor was one of your key ways of attempting to get redress. I'll try to make two quick points. One, Chinese citizens, in practice, resort to petitioning much more frequently than they resort to any other way of resolving their grievances. When you read stories in the press of Chinese citizens trying to seek an audience with an official or trying to present their grievances, what they're doing is they're petitioning. They're frequently trying to go to one of these letters and visits bureaus to get the attention of a central government official. This system does not work well. According to Yu Jianrong's study, only about 0.2% of all of these petitions are addressed. But what it reflects is a pervasive climate within the Chinese political and legal system where politics and law are really joined. I mean, if there's a party official who's standing behind the government and the courts, I mean, it kind of makes sense for citizens. Why go through the courts to try to address the problem? Why not simply try to present your problem to the party person who is, in the end, going to be the one who's going to instruct on how to resolve the issue? So what I'm seeing is sort of a pervasive effort on the parts of citizens to sort of resort to that system rather than the formal legal channels. And I'll...
But why do the new regulations on lawyers put out by the All China Lawyers Association, the so-called guiding opinion, why does that seem to preclude lawyers who were hired by a group of people who want to petition from helping those people?
Right.
As I understand it, the regulations say a lawyer can accept the invitation of the local authorities to take part in the petition process. But the lawyer may not accept representation if asked by a group of people. Why shouldn't the lawyers encourage this peaceful process of petitioning?
Fundamentally, the Xinfang system is not one aimed at equitably resolving the rights of individuals. Rather, it's a means of presenting information to government officials and allowing them to make a decision on whether or if to handle the problem.
Lawyers do that all the time in every system.
But lawyers, the difference between having a lawyer who's actually organizing large groups of people to present a problem, it involves more of a political challenge, and they're not comfortable with that.
But they want the help of the lawyers on the government side. They won't allow it on the people's side.
That's correct. They're interested, if it's controlled and organized by the local party officials. They're comfortable with it. They're not comfortable with somebody like Chen Guangcheng, who himself, independently or in association with a group of aggrieved residents, attempts to mount a collective challenge to government action. That's exactly right.
Eric McClayton, Institute of Foreign Policy Analysis. It seems to me that in recent years we've seen more high-visibility cases than we would have expected before. What's the nature of those, under what system, and maybe make a few comments about that?
I'm not totally sure high-visibility. I mean, the ones that have sort of made it into the Western media. I think, of course, one of the main reasons is you are getting more and more Chinese lawyers who know Jerry, you have more and more Chinese lawyers who themselves know how important it is for the purpose of trying to get pressure on the political figures who really can make a difference in resolving your case to try to attract media attention. So you're getting more and more Western-trained lawyers who have good English, who have connections with the New York Times reporters in Beijing, and try to get the information out. Now, of course, what this does is it means more and more of those lawyers are also themselves more and more high visibility, which is why they're getting thrown into prison.
Picking up on your answer regarding the foreign journalists, what do the recently issued or rules mean for the ability of foreign journalists to work in China?
That I would have to refer to one of my colleagues, former colleagues at the CCC, does media issues, and so he's more familiar with that. But I do recall that over the last couple months there have been restrictions as well on the. For example, there was a consideration of the law on sudden incidents. It's the Tufa Xing Shijian, something Fa. That's the one. There's a draft law under consideration by the NPC which would restrict domestic and foreign reporting on any sort of national. Emergencies, or you know, like a riot, or an earthquake, or a hurricane, you would not be allowed to report on these incidents before getting prior government approval, and that's actually caused a major stir within China itself as the Chinese media reacts to this.
Earl Carr from the Keenan Institute. Just picking up on this point as well. As I understand from the article that was published in the Financial Times on restricting of the media, as I understood it, was more of Xinhua wanting to have more control over what could be published in the press by foreign companies trying to restrict that. Is that correct? Is that your understanding?
Well, there are a couple different things going on. The one I was talking about was something that came out about 2 months ago. I had seen that piece as well on the restrictions of. Presentation of financial information or something like that. And I had remembered reading as well that was also something about Xinhua trying to assure its market position. So I think those are actually two different things.
One comment. One comment, one question. The comment is on the use of a lawyer or law versus Xinfang. So you mentioned about the possibility that Xinfang is not working, but the alternative interpretation would be the going through the legal process is rather expensive, and many of the cases which is does not worth doing. And our survey show that compared to 1993, the participation on any activities declined, but you know we see the dramatic increase of. Signing petition. So given the cost involved, the legal process, I think it's a... And my question is about, you know, we see in recently there are tightening of the control, we see the... But what are the reason behind it? Is this a temporary phenomenon, or this is a reflect a long-term a decision by the party?
Good question. I think the... first, on your first point, I completely agree. I wouldn't want to underplay the extent to which sort of access to legal channels is also just very expensive, and lawyers are scarce. So you resort to other efforts as well. The response to the second point, I've noticed it too. Within the last 3 years that it's become more evident, and I think it's. One big answer is the color revolutions. I think it's people are concerned about what happened in Kazakhstan and Ukraine. And so this is a general, they've had a rethink of civil society, they've had a rethink of foreign perceptions of foreign influence in China, and that's caused some serious concern. But I think it's you know, China's very big and you have lots of different folks in China talking about these issues, so it's really hard to say how long does this last, where is it going. So yeah, I wish I could, I can't really make a prediction like, yes, this is going to differently, this is going to last, because I also sense that there's a lot of the issues that I talked about, there are quite a many folks in China as well who realize that there's some real serious problems with local governance in China, and it's all tied up with some core issues of how the party state runs things.
Thanks very much, Carl, for your remarks. And on your first day as a think tanker, I can't let you get away without just reflecting a little bit on your experience over the past several years and thinking through these issues and trying to understand how best to convey them and make them resonate and to put forward reasonable policy recommendations which are both politically feasible as well as practically effective. Maybe you could reflect a little bit on the process of the CECC. We have another member of another former member of the CECC here, Jim Kelly, who might want to weigh in on that as well, and whether or not this has been generally effective. What are some of the obstacles to getting this research brought forward and integrated in an effective way, both at the executive and legislative levels. And then lastly, given everything that we've heard today, issues with which you're extremely familiar, I mean, what would be some of your top-line recommendations, both to the executive and the legislative branch, about what the United States needs to do, especially given what we're all sort of agreeing is a rather unfortunate turnaround, potentially, in China on a lot of these questions?
That's a very good question. I'll reflect first on my experience at the CECC, which, I mean, like I said, like Bates mentioned, my last week was last week, so I'm still very very affected by the experience. And, of course, it was a very positive one, so I really only have positive things to say. The one thing I think that's very nice about the CECC is the extent and the ability of the organization to go into depth in the issues. And I think, you know, when the hearing takes place on Wednesday, it'll also be the annual report will be released, and I think it's a very deep examination as to the issues that we're discussing here today. And my impression, just from what I hear around folks around DC, is it's actually something that's very useful for both the policy people, the academics, the NGO folks who all work on these issues. And with regard to sort of specific reflections as to sort of ideas of how to approach this, one of my big ones is, we were talking earlier about these very big terms such as democratization and rule of law. And I think that sometimes it's very hard to grasp in practice what those things mean. So that's why I like that concept, one, of focusing on something that's very specific, like this problem of local governance in China, which is really linked to all of the issues that we're interested in. And second, I think in talking with Chinese counterparts, one thing that I've found that's very effective is to point out not you're doing something wrong, you're not doing the way the Americans are doing it, rather what you're doing is having devastating results for your own ability to run your country. It sounds small, but you wouldn't believe the kind of impact that has when you're talking about, you know, human rights and democratization issues, and you're able to point out to Chinese sources, you're pointing to Chinese language materials, you're analyzing Chinese regulations, and you're saying this is having serious problems for Chinese citizens, and Chinese officials and Chinese media and Chinese citizens are all pointing these things out. It's a really good way to engage on these issues because it's much more concrete. And it gets away from you should do it like we do it.
3 points. I think the report put out this year and in past years by CECC is the best compendium available in quick real time about all these questions we're interested in. It's comprehensive, it's balanced, objective. It's, if they wouldn't print it in such small type, it would even be accessible. Second, I think this question of what we should do. Obviously, what we're doing here today is part of a broad process outside of China that we hope will stimulate reforms in China. We obviously have very limited impact, but China is respectful to some extent of the world. They have many leaders who want their country to be seen as a civilized government. The Olympics is merely one occasion for that. And so we hope this is a kind of a negative stimulus, but often offers positive suggestions. But beyond that, what should we be doing? I think all of us should be trying to cooperate with China to the extent possible, despite all the limitations we've talked about. The fact is, the government at most levels and Chinese educational and professional institutions now welcome cooperation more than they've ever done before. And nobody may agree with this recent policy or that, but here is an opportunity to cooperate. Now, there are real limitations, and there are dangers for some of the partners on the Chinese side, and we know that. But we should do more. And finally, the government, U.S. Congress and the State Department, should do much more to support this kind of effort. Right now, there's money available for legal training. If you want to put on programs to train Chinese defense lawyers or judges, that money is there. But this kind of work has to have a basis in research. We have to know more about why we're training, what are we training, what works in China, what doesn't work in China, not merely try to transplant things from our own society or for some third country. I am eternally frustrated. I shouldn't bite the hand that feeds me because our training efforts are being supported. But what isn't being supported, if you apply and you say, the most important thing in legal reform in China is the development of a fair and impartial judiciary. We know this has been done in other East Asian societies, starting in Japan in the 19th century, in Taiwan and South Korea more recently. How did these things happen? What are the factors that made it possible? Political, economic, social, professional, etc. And what has been the experience of previous efforts in China to do this? Why have they failed? What would work today? This is all basic research. The government doesn't fund that. They only want to fund immediate practical training things, even though we may not know why it is we're doing the training. Now, that's wrong. That has to be expanded. Congress has lots of money for the China purposes. Everybody's worried about China. This is the real opportunity to fund basic research. We used to have these arguments 30, 40 years ago about whether the government should fund basic research in the sciences. We got over that a long time ago. We should have the same kind of support for research into contemporary and past Chinese society and its comparative dimensions.
I'll just say one thing about Jerry's comment. I also agree on the cooperation aspect. I mean, I do think that for Americans and Chinese who are really serious about looking at these issues, like I was suggesting, there's actually overlap between, for people who are really serious about looking at these issues, I think there's overlap for figuring out how to deal with it.
If I could just follow up on what Jerry said, Chuck Fishman from Temple University. The funding that is being provided by the government for rule of law training is really being provided in a too narrow a basis. Too narrow a track. The definition that's being used today, which was not being used yet when you were there, but has since you left, now is limited just to democracy, human rights, and labor's definition of what rule of law training should be. And it therefore eliminates all other aspects of the law, which are not without their implications for democratization. And I'm thinking specifically of things like commercial law subjects, where governments do get sued, and governments have to obey legal decisions that are not in the democratization area, but in the commercial area. And that goes on throughout the entire area of legal training right now with what is being funded by the federal government.
Any other?
Hello, I'm David Kalig at State Department. I have a question. It's sort of taking the other side of the question about what can American scholars think about and to do better cooperation with China. I'm quite intrigued with the influence that Chinese scholars have on Chinese government policy. I was thinking about the petition system and Yujian Rong, actually, which you mentioned. Because right. I remember in 2004, he did a study on the petition system at the request of the State Council. And there was a lot in the Chinese press, and you kind of pieced together what the report was. And then the following January, there came out these rules about the petition system, stressing that it's important that people do have these rights to petition, but also limiting the number of people who can do petitions, which I think might have something to do with this thing that Jerry mentioned about the lawyers and how many people, because it's conceivable, too large a number of people petitioning is illegal, and you have to report it to something like that. So I'm intrigued by the influence of Yujian Rong, and you read other people in this field in China. Many of them have similar ideas of to Yujian Rong, and then you read some of the meetings of scholars and economists, and they sound quite radical, like they're badly kind of controlling their fury, but they see, well, we need to do it in a peaceful way. And then I think all about Yujian Rong's, the article they did about 4 years ago, the political risk that the petition system represents, with the idea that if this goes on and on, more people will be more and more disillusioned. And that's another Yujian Rong said, well, he decided people in Beijing, that half of them, the petitioners, had already tried at the local level through the courts, and they failed. So I'm kind of wandering here. But I wonder, is this just a Yujian Rong happens to be very influential, or are they taking a whole lot of scholarly advice? Out of my
question. Well, I don't think that they really adopted his proposals. I mean, if you look at the specific proposals that he had, there were sort of coding much more substantial political change. But that's a good example of what happens in China when you have these scholars. I mean, you have people who are content to work within the system, work for various academic research institutes, present their findings to higher government officials and let them make a decision on whether or not to adopt them. And, you know, of course, that always ends up at some point. You have higher-level party institutions that, you know, they think, interesting idea, but we're a little bit uncomfortable with the idea that it might change centralized party control. So I think that frequently happens with a lot of these proposals that folks are making.
Word for Chinese law professors. Chinese law professors are a significant influence. They are maybe the most important influence for law reform in China. They have very close and cooperative interaction with the officialdom, whether in the legislature, the state council, the ministries, the law societies, whatever. They draft things often on their own initiative. There are several drafts of a new criminal procedure law that are quite stimulating and made use of by officialdom contemplating whether to enact such a new law. These are significant people. They're more important than their American counterparts. When I first visited China in 1972, there were no Chinese law professors one could find in Beijing. They were all down on the farm having their heads reshaped. The next year, a few of them floated back, and when I met them, they were distinguishable from their American counterparts in two respects. One, they looked a lot healthier. They had deep suntans from working in the fields. I'd been working in the library. But the other was more troublesome. They spoke a lot less. They had nothing to talk about at that point, 1973, and they were afraid to say anything because of their experiences, starting with the anti-rightist movement and the Cultural Revolution. Now, it's a totally different world. It's true, if Ho Wei Feng from Beida is too outspoken, they'll tell him to shape up. And if Mr. Tung Biao from Zhenghua Dashui says too much about Cheng Guangcheng, they may say, perhaps you'll lose your job. There are pressures like that. But these guys are a terrific bunch. They're not of one view, but generally very progressive, very active, and some even take part in concrete cases. So this is a group that's very important, and their influence is often not seen, but very, very important, and we should support them.
Carl actually, in accepting the invitation to speak today, warned me that he needed to be on a train and be heading up to New York for another engagement. So I am very, very conscious of the time. I want to make sure you don't miss that
Thank
train,
you.
Carl. Do you want to take one more question from Dr. Pillsbury?
Sure. Why don't I go ahead and do that?
It's a bit of good news, too. And my question would be, to what degree did the commission, or would you in your year with the Council of Foreign Relations now, examine the Chinese military's approach to the law? The reason I say that is the Chinese military, in exchange programs with us and DOD, to my great surprise, is very proud of their own legal reforms. They've now passed, I don't know how many volumes, through the NPC of how our Chinese military will be under the rule of law. And I got taken in one time to a library, to follow on Jerry Cohen's point, with a lot of open source journals by law professors in Chinese about reforms. And there's quite the PLA journal with me said this is, you know, all of our professors are debating how to reform the party inspection discipline system, many other things that you've worked on. They have translations, by the way, in Chinese of your commission reports in this library. And I said, well, what about, what's the so what? Is the PLA in this? They said, yes, we have PLA lawyers, law professors, who go to all these meetings, these task forces. I said, well, surely you're the most conservative, you know, dinosaurs. No. They said, we often are the liberals who are using our prestige in the party to advocate more reforms. Huh. In the rule of law. This, I have nearly fainted, Frank.
Well, who would think that the U.S. military lawyers would be important forces in upholding the rule of law in our country?
They were not coerced. They were not coerced. So my question is, for all of you here, do you ever include the PLA law professors and this new experiment to have the rule of law in the military in China? In your research, and because they seem to be quite proud of it, then there's a dark side. You say, well, why do you do all this? And they say, surely you, Dr. Pillsbury, surely you know the 38th Army commander who was put in jail for not carrying out his orders because they were verbal and not in writing, a legal point, of course. He sat in the jail cell next to Mrs. Mao. And he's still there. And all the PLA seems to know this story. This poor general just said, let me have that in writing, then I'll kill the students. And he couldn't get it in writing. So now they want this massive rule of law for the PLA to prevent that from happening again. So is this part of your, could this be part of your future work?
That's an interesting question, and I have to admit, I had never thought of that. I mean, the commission mandate that we do for the Congressional Executive Commission on China, we're sort of a specific legislative mandate that's set out what we're supposed to look at, and the military stuff is not one of them. There's the other commission, which is the Security and Economic Review Commission, and maybe that they do economic and military-related issues, so it might fall under their bailiwick, perhaps. But that's a very interesting, it's an interesting point that I had not thought about before. Wouldn't surprise me that sort of all of the same issues that we've been talking about here are replicated in the military structure as well. So
we should let Carl grab his train. Please do join me because this is on very short notice. I think Carl's done a great job in helping us understand these issues a lot more clearly about the commission and some really good ideas going forward. Let me also extend my gratitude to all of our presenters this morning, and a special thanks to my staff, Sabina Rupani, Melissa Murphy, Lu Xiaoqing, Huang Jinhao, and also our interns for being so helpful in making this all come together. Thanks again.